throughout Northeast Pennsylvania, or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Today on the big program, Roger Hickey, co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, going to be here talking about the jobs numbers. And, you know, while it's starting to look like we're coming out of this, even with all the obstruction, after all the delay, after all of the gridlock that the Republicans have portrayed there and have done there in Washington, still added some jobs. Not enough. We got a lot more to do. If we had smart policy, smart investments, smart people in Washington who weren't ideologically predisposed to scorched earth, maybe we'd have gotten out of this. And I go back to January of 09 when we were losing hundreds of thousands of jobs a month, January, February, all those months, several hundred thousand jobs a month. It's easy to forget. It's easy to forget that in September 08 when all this really began, when the collapse, when the floor let loose because of really bad, insane policy. The same policy that the right is trying to ram down our throat again. You listen to every one of these candidates. It's all the same. Very cookie cutter. We need to double, triple, quadruple down on the same bad policy, the same failures that got us into this mess. So like I said, it's easy. It's easy to forget 700,000 jobs lost in a month. It's easy to forget. But what we have to remember is to this point, you've had one party in this country since the collapse who has been doing everything they can possibly do to stall, to delay, to gridlock, to obstruct, because they can't get their own way. So we'll talk to Roger about that. Also in the second hour, Lawrence Korb, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, their military expert, going to be here talking about Iran. You know, what should we be doing with the saber rattling that's going on and also the Pentagon budget cuts? What kind of a military do we have in the 21st century? How much is it going to cost? And are we really cutting military spending, or are we just slowing the growth? Are we going to be weaker because of it, or is it all just rhetoric? It'll be interesting talking to Larry about that. Also, Vicky Shambo, she is director of work and family programs at the National Project for Women and Families. Going to be here talking about this Supreme Court case that's going to be heard, I think it's next Wednesday. They're going to be hearing this case, Coleman versus the Maryland Court of Appeals, where this guy, you know, got sick. Like any of us could. Went to his doctor. Doctor said, you know, you need bed rest. You need to take some time off work. Went back to his employer, said, look, my doctor said I need to take some time off. I need to heal myself. Well, his employer fired him. Fired him. Said he wasn't eligible for the Family Medical Leave Act, which, again, you know, the whole reason we passed that thing is so that if you get sick, you're not going to lose your job. If you have a child and maybe you want to spend a little time. I mean, this is where the whole family values argument comes in. You have a child, you want to spend a little time with that kid. You can take a couple of weeks off. Unpaid, mind you, but still you can take some time off. If a parent gets sick, a child gets sick, your spouse gets sick, you can take some time off to care for them. Good, solid family values. Something one would think conservatives would be all in favor of. Something they would have fought tooth and nail for. But it seems every chance they get. And this is why I always ask the question. When you look at a politician, do you really think that they're conservative or are they corporatists? There's a difference between a conservative who believes in family values and believes in fiscal responsibility and believes in an institution. You know, that's the conservative. I'm okay with those people. They have a set of core beliefs. It's the corporatists that scare me. And I see Rick Santorum as that corporatist. He's a guy who's whatever business wants. If business doesn't want to pay health care for employees who may have a pre-existing condition, so what? The heck with them. I think it was today he told some woman that, since you got sick and got cancer, you should have to pay higher insurance rates. I mean, isn't that the whole idea of insurance pooling, that we all come together to minimize the risk to the individual? I mean, isn't that the point? It was at the beginning. What it's turned into is, one, how do the investors profit off of it? And two, how do the insurance companies keep enough of it so they don't have to pay out? So that's what we'll talk about with Vicky. And also in the third hour, David Prosp, he's going to be here. He's a union steward for the Teamsters Local 776 in Milton, PA. We're going to be talking about the strike that's going on there on the pipeline. Again, you know, they keep telling us these jobs that the Marcellus Shale people are bringing in, going to be good-paying, family-sustaining jobs, yet you look at what's going on and you got to go, not so much. So it'll be interesting to talk to Dave about that. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So with the primary season in full swing, Iowa behind us, New Hampshire coming up next week. We're going to be leaving for New Hampshire on Saturday. Going to spend the day Sunday talking to people and be right here Sunday, Monday and Tuesday to broadcast what's going on. Going into the belly of the beast. We're going to be in the hotel where the Republicans are going to have all their shindigs. All the candidates are going to have their big parties. Hopefully we're going to be able to get a number of them on the program. And you'll be able to hear firsthand, unvarnished, what their positions are. After New Hampshire, of course, it'll be about 11 days to South Carolina. Then you got Florida, Nevada, and Maine. Nevada and Maine have caucuses, much like Iowa, and then you head into Colorado, Minnesota, Missouri, and right on down the line until Super Tuesday, which is March 6th of this year. And then here in Pennsylvania, it's almost, I guarantee it's done by the time it gets here to Pennsylvania on April 24th. The primary is just kind of a formality at that point. But the reason we're going out to this thing, and I think it's important, is I want to be able to look some of these folks in the eye. And I think you get a better sense of people when you talk to them face to face. Like Rick Santorum. There's been this kind of push going on that, you know, he's this, you know, this really big anti-union guy. And I think he is. And there's a push, you know, also trying to say, well, he's not as anti-union as you might think because he's voted for this and he's voted for that. And you may say, yeah, okay, he voted for things that at one point may have benefited the union. And I talked about that yesterday. There were some votes that he threw to protect Davis Bacon. Did he do it for the working people? No. And don't try and spin it that way. He did it for the big corporations. That's who he cares about. He didn't throw a vote to the steel workers, he threw a vote to the steel industry. And it's important to remember those things. When you look at how these votes come down, it's political calculus. Now, Santorum's taken some heat over having endorsed Romney at one point. And now he's going after Romney, and he's coming around saying, well, you know, it was political calculus. I had to decide whether it was Romney or McCain. So I guess his disdain for McCain, much worse than it was for Romney, which is kind of interesting that McCain has now endorsed Romney in probably one of the most backhanded ways you probably could. Actually, and you got to wonder if it was a real true flub or if it was one of those things that slipped out of his mouth that he meant to say, but he said that Obama was going to turn the economy around. And if you look at the job numbers, slowly we're digging out of this thing. It would be a lot quicker if we got help from the folks on the right, but not happening because, well, they're blocking and obstructing. And you look at what happened today. Nancy Pelosi and a bunch of the Democrats went to the floor. And they said, well, look, we're here. We're ready to get to work. We're ready to, to get a jobs bill passed. We're ready to do our job. And where are the Republicans? They said, where are you at? When are you coming back to work? We need to get the payroll tax extension done. We need to help folks with unemployment. We need to get this stuff done. Well, Representative Jeff Denham, Republican from California, he was there representing the House Republicans. He banged the gavel and then shut off the CNN feed. No microphones. Everything went dead. And you kind of got to go, I thought this was a new era of government. I thought this was open transparency and accountability and a meritocracy, and the new sheriffs were in town. They were going to do things differently than Pelosi and the Democrats did. Help me here, because what I'm seeing is I'm seeing a lot of people taking a lot of time off. You know, I'm in favor of next November getting about 200 of them on unemployment myself. But it's all in the messaging. It's all in the media messaging. And I hope that turns around. That's why we're going to New Hampshire, and I think we're going to have a great time up there talking to folks. Anyway, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Roger Hickey, co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org. Quick break, right back after this.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
We don't think it's an exaggeration to say that people could literally freeze to death in their homes as a result of this corporate decision.
USW Local 101 Vice President Jim Savage talking about possible home heating oil supply disruptions from the closing of three refineries in the Philadelphia area. Sunoco and ConocoPhillips plan to close three refineries and replace the product from those plants with imports. USW says losing these three refineries will also diminish the ability to make up losses in case Gulf Coast refineries are again disabled by hurricanes. USW Local 10234 President Dennis Stefano says that about 1,400 United Steelworker jobs will be destroyed, along with hundreds of building trades and management jobs, and local government and schools will lose millions of dollars. The union wants to keep the refineries open.
Very companies that are shutting down our refineries right now are the ones that are going to be importing, putting us out of work and replacing our good middle-class paying jobs with imported product. Before any more refineries are shut down in the United States, we absolutely believe Congress should require the CEOs, people making the decisions to close these refineries down, to come before Congress and explain why they're being shut down.
The attack is on the working people, and the attack is against collective bargaining, whether it's private or public workers. We're under attack right now.
International Longshore and Warehouse Union Local 21 President Dan Kaufman says his union is determined to fight the EGT company to the bitter end, as the company tries to bust the ILWU at the Port of Longview in Washington State. Kaufman says the ILWU will meet a grain ship expected to come into the port soon in an effort to stop it from being loaded with non-union labor. ILWU and the local Central Labor Council in the Longview area have put out a labor call to action to make sure the ship is met by a massive protest. Kaufman says ILWU supported Wisconsin's worker uprising to defend public worker collective bargaining, and he vows ILWU will keep fighting the ongoing attacks on the union rights of workers.
The ILWU said, we've had enough. I know the people of Wisconsin said, we have had enough, and we're fighting back.
The Washington Education Association has won a lawsuit in which they accused the legislature of violating the Constitution by not properly funding the state's public education system. Jesse Russell reports.
The state Supreme Court ruled on Thursday that the legislature isn't doing enough and criticized the body for discussing reforms while making substantial cuts to education. Writing for the majority, Justice Deborah Stevens said the court wouldn't stand by as the legislature makes unfulfilled promises. The court has given lawmakers until 2018 to put reforms in place in an attempt to curtail what has become a pattern of moving the reform deadline further down the road. The ruling by the Washington State Supreme Court echoes a similar decision in 1978, which the court used as precedent for making such a demand of the legislature.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Got 5 ways to hold it to account. We put in 5 ways to snuff our voices out. Can you hear us?
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. So according to the latest numbers from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the U.S. economy added some 200,000 jobs last month, and the unemployment rate fell to 8.5%. The private sector added 212,000 jobs, while, of course, again, the public sector lost more jobs, 12,000. And you look at last year, public sector layoffs hit record high numbers. 183,064 workers lost their jobs due to budget cuts. And look, in conservative world, those are dream numbers. There's champagne being popped. There's high fives being made. According to analysis by the consulting firm Challenger Gray and Christmas, private sector layoffs accounted for nearly a third of the jobs lost. These numbers don't take into account the proposed 120,000 Postal Service jobs that could be lost in the coming year. But the jobs numbers, not bad. If we had a Republican Party who did what they said in November of 2010, laser-like focus on jobs, instead of obstruction, delay, and scorched earth, maybe we'd had better numbers. That's why I've asked Roger Hickey, co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org, to come talk to us a little bit. Roger, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi, Rick. How are you doing?
I'm good, and it looks like the economy is slowly moving in the right direction.
Well, it's certainly better that there's a net 200,000 new jobs than it'd be terrible if it was sliding backwards.
Yeah, and you know, I tried to remind people. You know, the reality is, you go back to September of 2008, September, November, December, January of 2009, we were losing hundreds of thousands. We were in a free fall before this president took office.
And the president, no doubt, created jobs and stopped the downward spiral that could have turned into the Great Depression. And now, slowly, we're starting to replace the jobs that got lost during the recession. And the problem, of course, is that we're not growing fast enough.
Right.
Because we've got about 2.5 million jobs that were lost during the recession. But there's also a lot of people who come into the labor force or would like to be in the labor force every month, and we're still not creating enough jobs. We're not growing at the 4% and 5% level that we should be to be recovering all those jobs and putting everybody to work.
Right, we're not keeping up with demographic growth,
right,
is what you're saying. And you know, and looking at these jobs numbers for the first time, I think in quite some time. In the manufacturing sector, we added 23,000 jobs. And if you look at over the last 10 years, we've lost at least a third of our manufacturing capacity. But to see just a little uptick, 23,000, not a lot, but it's still, stopping the loss at least for a month.
Yeah, and there are some companies that are starting to realize producing in China for the U.S. market is pretty expensive. So there's some sense that we're starting to produce in the U.S. again, although we need to work on that much more than we have been.
I mean, the key to all of this, in my opinion, is one, doing infrastructure improvements. We need to get people back to work in the construction industry, and right now is the best time to be borrowing money because it's almost interest-free. But the other part of this is to start looking at our trade policies, start looking at the way things are coming into the country and re-incentivize, if you have to, encourage people bring manufacturing back.
And that should be what this election campaign is all about. The Democrats have laid out the American Jobs Act, which doesn't go far enough in my mind. The Republicans have an ideology that just says slash the budget and somehow magically jobs will come back. Give tax cuts to the corporations that are already sitting on billions of dollars in profits, and somehow they will invest in jobs. There needs to be a real debate in this election about which party has the better vision for jobs. And then there's going to be a battle next month about whether the Republicans allow us to even continue to extend unemployment benefits, which is helps the economy, whether we continue to cut the Social Security tax to put more money in people's pockets to keep the economy growing. The Republicans have not been clear about whether they're going to allow that to happen. And, of course, if they don't, it means a hit of a million jobs at least lost to this economy.
Well, I think two things are probably going to happen. One, they're going to ideologically, you know, they want to oppose it. But the political realities are, like you said, you're going to lose a million jobs. And everyone will then see what I've been seeing for the last 2 years, which has been gridlock, obstruction, delay, poison pilling every piece of legislation designed to create jobs in what Limbaugh said, I want Obama to fail. What McConnell said, want to make him a one-term president. To me, everything they're doing is about getting that black guy out of the White House.
So we've been warning the White House, don't brag too much. This is not enough growth, and challenge the Republicans to help the economy along, and brand them as killing jobs if they show any sign of opposing these really modest plans, you know, we've got to extend what they extended only for 2 months. But the White House then needs to campaign on a big infrastructure investment plan, just that, like you were talking about, and a plan for rebuilding manufacturing.
I'm right there. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Roger Hickey, co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org, the website. You know, one of the things I've advocated for some time, and it kind of gets cold reception a little bit, I don't say no more extensions. Stop with the extensions of unemployment. Get people jobs. I think the government should, at a certain point, be the employer of last resort. There are so many things that need to be done, and I do believe there are therapeutic qualities to work, you know, a job well done, you know, all of that stuff that can, I think, lift us out of what some people, you know, are calling some kind of doldrum.
Yeah, and I agree with you that the president and the Democrats need to talk. They can walk and chew gum at the same time. Extend those short-term stimulus, but also say, I plan to create jobs for everybody who needs to work. Yeah, and if they're public jobs, they're going to be productive jobs, and make that part of the election campaign. Tell the voters to give us a Congress that will actually work on creating jobs.
And I'm in favor of going after corporate profits. Look, I'm sorry, if you're as wildly profitable as a lot of these companies have been, and you're cutting workers and you're cutting their pay, I think you should have to pay a higher tax. And I've been saying this whole week that, you know, we keep hearing the Republicans talk about liberty and freedom and justice and all of these highbrow ideas. How is that possible when 90% of the workforce, 90% of the people in this country work for somebody and are, you know, they're dependent on that person for their existence, yet that person has no responsibility back for them?
I'll tell you, you're absolutely right. People, workers have a whole lot more freedom when they know they can walk down the street and get a new job. If they are totally dependent on one employer and there's a whole lot of unemployment all around them, that's not freedom. That's hanging on for dear life. So we've got to create enough jobs so that people feel the freedom to be able to walk across the street and get a better job, or go on strike and demand better wages.
I'm right there with you. You know, and I look at I saw a report this week that corporate profits back up, actually, you know, better than they were before the recession, and yet the tax rates, what we're collecting back from them, are way, way down. And I keep saying, you know, obviously cutting corporate taxes, not the way to go. It's not working. Yet every one of the Republican presidential candidates, every one of them, in favor of cutting corporate taxes, in favor of cutting taxes on the very wealthy, and raising taxes on the people who are already struggling enough.
You know, the Democrats need to have their version of that argument. The Democratic version should be, let's put enough people to work, as cops, as teachers, as firefighters, as people cleaning up the community and doing energy retrofits, so that there's enough people able to spend money in the local stores that those companies start to hire and start to invest because they've got paying customers. The reason those companies who have their taxes slashed are not using their profits to invest in jobs is that they're not seeing enough demand. In community after community, people can barely get by. So our version of getting the economy moving is get the consumers employed, and that will create enough demand that the private sector will feel the need to invest and to grow. So we have our own version. It's a lot better than the trickle-down kind of economics that the Republicans talk about.
Yeah, I haven't trickled down enough, thanks so much. but, you know, you look at this, and every small business person I talk to, they say the exact same thing. I need people coming in the door. I need people putting money in my cash register. I need product going off the shelves. And the sad reality is folks are struggling just to put food on the table. There's not much left for discretionary spending. There's not much left out to go to dinner or go to movies or do any of the things that generate economic activity in the community.
Yep, and that's what makes small business and large business feel confident enough to hire another worker, pay for another piece of machinery, and get the economy growing. They need demand.
And what's going on? And I just saw a report this week also that wages are now worse than they were pre-recession because, you know, wages keep going down even after they declared the recession over as well. And I'm going, yeah, that's because these big corporations, they figured it out. We can extort our workers. We can take money back from them and say, hey, at least you got a job, even if it's only paying half of what it was before, which is why I say we need comprehensive labor law reform in this country to be able to allow people to collectively bargain and to stop this nonsense of independent contractors or mislabeling or misclassifying employees to begin with.
Well, you're absolutely right. If we don't have a middle class that has decent wages, and the bargaining power to demand those wages, and a union backing them up, this country is going in a spiral downward. And the opposite is true. If we have people with a union, with money in their pocket, full employment, that's when the companies need to grow and need to invest and feel the need to expand. This unemployment number is good only if it continues to get better.
Right.
And we've got a fight on our hands over the next period showing the voters that it's the Republicans who are thwarting job growth. It's the Republicans and the conservatives who are strangling the economy and keeping us from growing at our real potential.
Yeah, I don't think there's any argument there, though. But the reality is, look at all the 24-type hostage situations we've seen over the last 2 years. Every time taking us to the brink of disaster, and even causing, what I'm saying, causing our credit rating to go down.
Well, I hope you're right, and I know that that every day you're making those explanations. But there's a huge propaganda machine on the other side who are claiming that the Democrats are creating the economic problem. So we've got to go out there and talk to the voters and say, let's get a Congress and a president who are willing to spend the money to create jobs and get the economy rebuilt.
I'm right there with you. Last question I've got for you, just to change topics a little bit. Are you happy with the fact that President Obama recess-appointed Richard Cordray and the folks over at the NLRB? Because I'm thrilled with it.
It's a great sign. The president is now giving up on bending over backward to cooperate with the Republicans. And he's showing that he's willing to fight for a regulator who will regulate the banks and an NLRB that will stand up for workers' rights. This is not the last word. The Republicans are going to holler and squeal, and we need to support the president. And the other thing we're saying to the president is, okay, you've created a consumer protection guy who's going to run that agency. Now let's work with the attorney generals who are trying to prosecute some of these bankers.
Yes.
Who ripped us off during the great run-up to the recession.
Absolutely.
And the president still has not done that. So we've got to tell him, all right, consumer protection in the banking system is one thing. Let the attorney general take these guys to jail and stop making deals with the bankers. That ought to be prosecuted.
That's what I want to see. I want to see perp walk summer. I want to see a perp walk every day all summer long.
Well, there's plenty of attorneys general in the states who are willing to do it if the president will get out of the way.
Well, I'm hoping you're right on this. I would love to see.
But it's a very, very good sign that the president went out and said, I don't care what the Republicans are doing. I'm going to appoint a consumer protection czar. And I'm going to make the Labor Relations Board, able to function now and protect workers' rights.
And I would have done that across the government. There are hundreds of positions that the Republicans are blocking and delaying and not allowing confirmation on. I would have done it all in one day, but I understand the political realities.
It's a good start.
Roger Hickey, I appreciate the time. Always great talking with you.
Great to be with you, Rick. Take care.
Thanks so much. Roger Hickey, co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org, the website. Quick break, right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Reason and community come together. The Rick Smith Show.
Congress. How small-minded is it? How tangled up in a right-wing ideological knot is it? How subservient to corporate lobbyists is it? The answer to these three questions are pizza, tomato paste, and spuds. At a time when doctors and nutritionists are sounding a national alarm about a diabetes epidemic caused by gross obesity, including in children, the Congress of the United States of America, in all of its majesty, has killed an effort by the Agriculture Department to make school lunches healthier. Why? Three reasons. One, Congress is incapable of meeting America's big needs, so it's rationalizing its existence by messing with the small stuff. Two, Congress's right-wing ideologues are so batty that they even oppose federal rules to improve our children's health. Three, and most significant, the French fry lobby, tomato paste lobby, and frozen pizza lobby put big bucks into congressional campaigns and they pulled the strings of our lawmakers. So the financial interests of corporate powers, including Coca-Cola, ConAgra, and Del Monte, have overridden the interests of America's school kids. Yet, members of Congress still say they can't figure out why their public approval rating has crashed to an all-time low of 9%. Nine! Good grief! As Senator Michael Bennett recently pointed out to his colleagues, oil giant BP, at the height of its disastrous contamination of our Gulf, held on to a 16% approval rating. The IRS gets a 40% rating on its job performance. And even the idea of America becoming communist draws 11% support. This is Jim Hightower saying, the real question is, who makes up the 9% that approve of this Congress? I'm guessing they're relatives, staffers, and the two Koch brothers. Plus, of course, corporate lobbyists.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Volkswagen just invested in Tennessee in a right-to-work state at a low cost with less health care. Why should we prop others up when other companies can compete in this marketplace? It's time to let these people learn the lesson the hard way.
You know, I remember that. I remember Zach Womp, the congressman from Tennessee, saying, let them fail. Oh, we don't need them. Let them file bankruptcy. Let them go through. That's why we have bankruptcy laws. And again, I mean, they're quite used to using the bankruptcy laws, you know, basically sticking it to the taxpayers. But, you know, I go back to that, man.
Volkswagen just invested in Tennessee in a right-to-work state at a low cost with less health care. Why should we prop others up when other companies can compete in this marketplace? It's time to let these people learn the lesson the hard way.
Let them learn the lesson the hard way. Now, understand, congressman from Tennessee, let's see, he said Volkswagen just invested in Tennessee, a right-to-work state. Less wages, less benefits. Already telling, right out of his mouth, saying, we want workers making less wages. We want them making less health care, less pension, less all of that. We want working people, well, at the bottom level. And you hear Michelle Bachmann, you hear the rest of them. Oh, the minimum wage is, that's too much. The market should declare. So if the market says $1 an hour, that's what you're going to get paid? You should have no right to collective bargain. And that's pretty much what they're telling you. Now, understand, the Volkswagen plant in Tennessee, the state of Tennessee, all totaled up, gave that company $1 billion. Between the cash they gave them, the land, the guaranteed purchase of their vehicles, tax abatements, energy abatements, all kind of stuff. Hand it over. And you go, well, why couldn't they do that for the U.S. companies? Oh, that's right. They're trying to kill them. And it had to do with the union. And I look at this story I found in Forbes. And yesterday we had talked about the U.S. auto industry slowly coming back. They're slowly, they're doing a lot better. Profits were strong. Everything was doing all right this past year. It's creating jobs. Communities are coming back. It was a good story. I saw this story in Forbes. The headline, How Germany Builds Twice as Many Cars as the U.S. While Paying Its Workers Twice as Much. Because understand, in 2010, the automobile companies in Germany produced 5.5 million automobiles. The U.S. produced about 2.7 million. They're saying at the same time that they produce 5.5 million, U.S. produces 2.7 million. German auto workers made $67.14 an hour in salary and benefits. Here in the U.S., the average auto worker made about $33.77. That's health care, that's pension, that's hourly wage. Now, you look at BMW, you look at Mercedes-Benz, you look at Volkswagen, very profitable companies. How is that? How is it possible that you have a situation where an industry in Germany doing exactly the same thing with much tighter regulation, with much more oversight, much more scrutiny, and higher wage costs, how do they pay their workers $67 an hour and are wildly profitable, while here in the U.S. we can't seem to get our workers to make a reasonable bit of wage, and they're in trouble? Explain that to me. Well, what they're saying, there are two things. One, you have these works councils. It is actually in the German Constitution that allows for these works councils. And the idea, they say, is, look, at the end of the day, as a matter of constitution, you have the right to collective bargaining and labor employee management. And the other part of it is, in Germany, you actually have workers sitting on corporate boards. They're there for the decision-making process. Their voices are heard. Their ideas are part of it. And then the bigger part for me, it says virtually every auto worker in the country of Germany is part of the IG Metall, which is their version of the United Auto Workers. They're all union members. They're all in it. They're also members of the workers in the company. And one of the things that I find quite interesting, here in this country, we view union and management as butting heads. It's adversarial. It's we're constantly they have different ideas. They have different goals. And no, a worker and the company should they have the same goals. You want the company to be profitable so that I can make a decent wage, so that we all do better together. And you look if you look at the way we've done things here in the U.S., it's a situation where we are racing to the bottom by design, by pitting states against one another. Stop and think about the Boeing situation for a minute. We're pitting Washington against South Carolina. Why do you think they do that? Because strategically it's better to move a production facility away from where you have the brain capacity, which is in Washington, where you have the capital, the brain capital, where you have the skill, move it completely somewhere else, where you have to train an entire workforce. Is that strategically intelligent? No, the reason they did it, and they admitted to it, it's in writing, they went to get away from the union. They went to find an exploitable workforce. They went to find a pliable environment where they could hold the state hostage for revenue. And the state has given them big-time bucks. And also, not only the state of South Carolina given big bucks, Washington's given big bucks, and the people there are giving concessions. Why? Because you want to keep those jobs. Which is why the Republicans are so incensed that it didn't work. Because the NLRB said, well, wait a second. You were dumb enough to say we're moving because we want to break up the union. This is retaliation for you going on strike. We've got to do something here. And what I find absolutely amazing is that workers in this country didn't get that. And now you look at that story, you know, that I talked about the other day with Boeing in Wichita, Kansas. Got big money out of them, out of the state of Kansas. And they're still closing the place. It's insane. And I go back to Germany. They got people who sit on the board of directors. They've got workers, actual people who, on the shop floor, going up to sit with the CEO to talk about the direction and have a voice in the direction of the company. Because it matters as much to the guy sweeping the floor as it does to the CEO, the direction of that company. In fact, I would say it matters more to the guy on the floor than it does to the CEO. But in Germany, they're all in it together. They've got an idea. We need to make this company successful from the ground up. And that means everybody. Everybody should have a voice. We don't do that here. Who we care about, well, we care about the stockholders more than anything. We don't really care about the average worker. And I look at what this big pension fund in the Netherlands did. They're the Netherlands' biggest pension fund. I can't say the name. It's ABP is the letters. They've decided that they're going to divest more than $300 billion in assets. They've looked around. They've said, you know what? We are no longer supporting companies who do things we don't agree with. They looked at the United Nations Global Compact and said there's a company who is not complying with labor rights, with human rights, with environmental standards and their anti-corporate efforts, and we're going to divest them. You know who that company is? It's Walmart. The only retail company that they decided to divest. The other 15 companies that they blacklisted were all companies that made chemicals or nuclear weapons. That violated the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. They're using their money to make this world a better place. Here in the U.S., you can't do that. They went and they talked to the people at the New York pension, common pension plan, the big one that they've got there. And the first thing the guy said, well, you know, gee, we'd like to, but you know, we've got this thing called fiduciary duty. That's our main guide for us, which means I've got to think of the shareholder before I think of anything else. All I think about is the shareholder. Maximize shareholder wealth. And that, my friends, is what's bringing this country to its knees. We are making decisions based on a handful of people's narrow special interest, which is to put more money in their pockets. Instead of thinking of how is this going to affect the nation, how is this going to affect my community, how is this going to affect the globe, we think about how is it going to affect Warren Buffett, how is it going to affect the Koch brothers, how is it going to affect the Mellon Scaifes and the Coors and all of these other billionaires who've been influencing our policy for years. That's what we have to think about. I say what we need to start thinking about how is this going to affect my community? How is it going to affect the state, the country? That's what we need to be thinking about. Quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK,
1-888-520-7425. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
We think of the planet Mars as a world much like Earth. Both worlds orbit in the inner solar system, and they're similar in size.
But Mars might have developed very soon after the birth of our solar system, while Earth is thought to have formed much later. 4.5 billion years ago, a disk of gas and dust is thought to have surrounded the early Sun. Within the disk, kilometer-sized chunks of material called planetesimals collided to form the embryos of the planets we know today.
Earth is thought to have developed as late as 100 million years after the solar system began to form through a series of continued collisions. On the other hand, Mars might have stopped growing at its embryo stage only about 2 million years after the solar system began to take shape. If that's so, it would explain why Mars is the runt among inner worlds of our solar system and why its geology is profoundly different from that of Earth.
Astronomers refined the age of Mars by using carbon dating on Martian meteorites. So Earth formed through a series of collisions over tens of millions of years. But Mars may be a solitary embryo, a world that did not undergo continuous collisions. To learn more, come to EarthSky.org and search for Mars Embryo. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Bird. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
It was an inside job. Found a well connected. Your middle protest. Don't ever leave me shaking. It was an inside job. Like it always is. Talk it up. To business
as usual. And that's the problem. This whole business as usual nonsense. This whole the Tina argument. There's no alternative. There's nothing we can do. It's always been that way. We can't change. No, we can't do any of that stuff. Oh, that's impossible. We couldn't go to public transportation. We couldn't have a rail system. No, we need the car. So we need to sit in traffic for 2 hours to get someplace. There are so many things that we could do if we just had the will. And I look at this, and it's something that's bugged me for years. You look at CalPERS, the California pension system out there, one of the biggest pension funds in the country. And they do some social responsibility stuff, but they should be, and I shouldn't put it that way because they do a lot, but they should be just one of many that are doing. Every pension fund that is worker-based should be pooling together and be – and. Like they do in other countries. And you support companies that support workers. That only makes sense. Using the capital that we have to do what the right does only for better reasons. You know, I talked a little bit yesterday about my mortgage, and like I said, I paid my mortgage off because I want that security of knowing that my house is paid for. What a very rich person would do, what one of these hedge fund managers would do, is they would leverage the house to the hilt. They would take out a loan 125% of the value of the house, and they'd buy something else, and they'd leverage that 125%, and then they'd buy something else, and they'd leverage that, kind of like Romney and Bain Capital. And they'd make much more money. They'd make tons of money. And it's the goal for them is only making money for themselves. Why couldn't we have a system where we said, you know what, we're gonna use kind of that principle. We're going to buy something. And we're going to use that to buy something else. And we're going to make sure that they're interlined and that they help each other and that they raise conditions. And I look in Cleveland, where I grew up. Now, the Cleveland Project, there are 1,000 companies that are doing just that. And they're small companies. They're interlined together, and their idea is we're going to create good jobs. We're not going to create profits for wealthy investors. We're going to create good jobs. We're going to create an environment for workers to be able to live the American dream. And I saw this Reuters story today about Mitt Romney and Bain Capital. And we're going to see a lot of these stories because they did a lot of this during the 80s and the 90s. They bought up companies that were making a profit. They weren't setting the world on fire. They weren't blowing the doors off the place, but they were making a profit. They were making their way. They were paying good wages. They were the anchor of the community. And they were small, local, regional place, whatever, but they were making it. And in comes these vultures. And I like what the one guy said. He said, you know, we saw these young guys coming in business suits. And they're looking around, and you could tell they'd never seen anything like this steel mill. It's in Kansas City. It was called Worldwide Grinding Systems. This big steel mill with 10-foot cast buckets, way up in the air, these huge cranes swinging these big buckets, and you can see these kids look like school kids. This guy called them a bunch of Wall Street preppies. And he said, you saw them. They were just kind of sheepishly looking around and real tentative. Didn't know a thing about what was going on. They bought the company. And, in the next 10 years, they ran into the ground by saddling it with massive debt, taking out the money that they had in the pension, using that to buy something else. The same story over and over again. So in less than a decade, padlocked, locked the doors, company's gone, 750 people lost their jobs. No severance pay, no health insurance like they had been promised, none of that. The pension that they worked their behinds off, slashed by $400 a month. And you know what? You and me, we had to bail their pension out. We had to give them $44 million. Because they underfunded their pension. They were supposed to be making pension contributions, and oh, gee, that didn't happen. They used that somewhere else. And, of course, Bain Capital, making their balance sheets look really good. They got $12 million out of their $8 million investment, and they ended up with $4.5 million in consulting fees. So they did great. They doubled their money. 750 families in the street. 750 families, as one guy put it, I lost a lot of sleep. I lost a lot of my life in the street. 700. That's one deal. How many hundreds did they do during the 80s and 90s? And this is the guy that wants to run the country? And we're going to do what he did at Bain Capital to the nation? That's what he's telling you. He's telling you, look, I'm a turnaround guy. I turned things around. In this case, turned it around all right. Closed. Turned it into open space. Which, if you want to make the argument, we need more green space, we can make that argument. But not at the expense of 750 working families. You know, they like to tout, oh, well, we did such a great job at Staples, Domino's, and Sports Authority. We did such a great job turning those companies around. Help me here. Just from a common sense point of view. Someone working for Worldwide Grinding Systems, a steel mill, a producer of a product, do you think they made a little bit more money than the kid working at Sports Authority or delivering my pizza from Domino's? Do you think they made maybe just a touch more than the guy working at Staples? I know they got the easy button and all, but I got to tell you, I think that steel worker job paid an awful lot more money to the worker, paid an awful lot more money in taxes to the community, produced a product that was used here in the U.S., and you know what? Help small businesses on Main Street survive. They go into another company, Kansas City Bolt and Nut Company, steelworkers. It was a job where in the summer, 100-degree temperatures. They used to wear long johns under their protective suits so they get some relief from the sweat. It was a good-paying job. People bought houses. They bought cars. They sent their kids to college. They took vacations. It was a middle-class job. It was a bust-butt job. You worked your behind off, but you made it a good living, and your kids had a better future. And it's the same story. Now, I don't need to go into all the details. You know what happened. They went in. They sucked all the assets out. They saddled it with huge debt, and they cut it off to die. Is that the direction we want the nation? And I think that's what this election is really about. When you sit down and you look at what they're talking about, all of them, across the board, no more corporate taxes, no more rich folk taxes, no more estate taxes, none of that stuff. But you know what they all advocate? Raising the bottom taxes. Oh, there are 46 million people who pay no taxes. Do you know why there are 46 million people who aren't paying federal income tax? They're paying a ton of other taxes, rest assured, but they're not paying the federal income tax. You know why? Because they don't have the minimum income to get to it. Yet they're out there. What I'd love to see, here's what I would love to see the Republicans say. If you're against the alternative minimum tax that says Warren Buffett's got to pay at least a certain percentage of tax, at least something. If you're against that, then you should be in favor of having an alternative minimum income. Because minimum wage doesn't put you out of poverty. If we're going to set the poverty level at $17,000, then $17,000 should be minimum pay for a job in this country. But I'll guarantee you, I will bet my last dollar on this planet that you won't find one of Snow White or the Seven Dwarfs willing to take that. Not one. Every one of them, they'll sign the we want to break the union pledge, or we're not going to raise taxes pledge, or all the other insane pledges they pull. You know they'll sign those. But when it comes to protecting workers, you're on your own, brother. This is the ownership society, didn't you know? Absolutely flat on your own. But they'll protect the bankers, boy. Oh, will they? Oh, I'll tell you. Anyway, when we come back, we're going to talk with Lawrence Korb, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, about what's going on in Iran. I know there's an awful lot out there. Also going to talk about the Pentagon cuts that have been talked about. Personally, I think it's a lot of hot air. But we're going to get it from the man, the expert himself, Larry Korb, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I ain't never been on welfare, and that's one place I won't be. I'll be working as long as my two hands are fit to use. I'll drink my beer in a tavern, sing a little bit of these working men.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
We don't think it's an exaggeration to say that people could literally freeze to death in their homes as a result of this corporate decision.
USW Local 101 Vice President Jim Savage talking about possible home heating oil supply disruptions from the closing of three refineries in the Philadelphia area. Sunoco and ConocoPhillips plan to close three refineries and replace the product from those plants with imports. USW says losing these three refineries will also diminish the ability to make up losses in case Gulf Coast refineries are again disabled by hurricanes. USW Local 10234 President Dennis Stefano says that about 1,400 United Steelworker jobs will be destroyed, along with hundreds of building trades and management jobs, and local government and schools will lose millions of dollars. The union wants to keep the refineries open.
Very companies that are shutting down our refineries right now are the ones that are going to be importing, putting us out of work and replacing our good middle-class paying jobs with imported product. Before any more refineries are shut down in the United States, we absolutely believe Congress should require, absolutely require the CEOs, people making the decisions to close these refineries down, to come before Congress and explain why they're being shut down.
The attack is on the working people, and the attack is against collective bargaining, whether it's private or public workers. We're under attack right now.
International Longshore and Warehouse Union Local 21 President Dan Kaufman says his union is determined to fight the EGT company to the bitter end, as the company tries to bust the ILWU at the Port of Longview in Washington State. Kaufman says the ILWU will meet a grain ship expected to come into the port soon in an effort to stop it from being loaded with non-union labor. ILWU and the local Central Labor Council in the Longview area have put out a labor call to action to make sure the ship is met by a massive protest. Kaufman says ILWU supported Wisconsin's worker uprising to defend public worker collective bargaining, and he vows ILWU will keep fighting the ongoing attacks on the union rights of workers.
The ILWU said, we've had enough. I know the people of Wisconsin said, we have had enough, and we're fighting back.
The Washington Education Association has won a lawsuit in which they accused the legislature of violating the Constitution by not properly funding the state's public education system. Jesse Russell reports.
The state Supreme Court ruled on Thursday that the legislature isn't doing enough and criticized the body for discussing reforms while making substantial cuts to education. Writing for the majority, Justice Deborah Stevens said the court wouldn't stand by as the legislature makes unfulfilled promises. The court has given lawmakers until 2018 to put reforms in place in an attempt to curtail what has become a pattern of moving the reform deadline further down the road. The ruling by the Washington State Supreme Court echoes a similar decision in 1978, which the court used as precedent for making such a demand of the legislature.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its science, the hope of its children.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So the president has come out with some ideas for cuts. Panetta has come out and talked about his idea of how to make the military a little more streamlined. The righties are going nuts. Folks are thinking, well, we're going to be cutting things down because, after all, we can only fight one war at a time. That's why I've asked Lawrence Korb, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. AmericanProgress.org is their website. Come talk to us about the numbers and our readiness and a couple other things. Larry, thanks for taking time for me.
Nice to be with you.
You know, I look at this and, you know, I think there's some panic going on from some on the right saying, oh, these cuts are gonna make us weak. Any truth to that?
No, not at all. In fact, if you compare it to past drawdowns that Eisenhower, who you quoted there, did after Korea, that Nixon did after Vietnam, and, you know, H.W. Bush did after the end of the Cold War. This is very, very, very minor, reductions. Eisenhower, cut defense spending by 30% in real terms. Obama's talking about 8%. you know, Nixon was about 29, you know. So, no, it's very, very minuscule, and it comes after 13 years of real increases, you know, even discounting for inflation.
Yeah, because we were at war. Because we were at war, and there was no cost.
No, that's the baseline budget, not the war budget.
Oh.
Okay, if you add the war, see, now this is the first time we've ever done this. We funded the war separately. If you put in war funding, and even if you control for inflation, we're spending more than at any time since World War II, more than Korea and Vietnam.
Wow. Wow. I didn't think it was that bad. I mean, I know we're spending a ton of money. I didn't think it was as bad as Vietnam or Korea even, but.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's higher even in real terms, you know. So when, you know, people, you know, talk about it, they, you know, and when you show them the numbers, they're just, you know, astounded. You know, for example, you know, Vietnam spending, again, I'm talking in today's dollars, peaked at about $400 billion. Okay. The war funding here and the defense budget peaked at over 700.
Wow. Wow.
So. Yeah, I mean, you know, Bob Gates, when he was secretary, talked about the gusher of defense spending. You know, it is. And even, you know, people like Admiral Mullen and General McChrystal will admit, hey, we didn't have to make any hard choices because the baseline budget was going up with the war funding because people did not want to be, quote unquote, seen as soft on defense and doing what we needed to win the wars.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, for a while you heard people saying, well, we need to spend whatever we need to spend because we've got to win. Nobody
right.
ever told me what winning was,
right,
but we needed
right.
to win.
And, you know, now that we're, you know, and again, we're talking what Obama was talking about, the baseline budget, okay? He's going to cut it by, over the next 10 years, 8%. You know, when I worked for Reagan, you know how much we cut it in his second term, we began to have deficit problems? 10%.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's not that much, but people who don't, you know, people do know what they're talking about, but, you know, and again, because most folks don't, you know, realize where we are, it sounds, you know, good. And, you know, cutting, you know, they're going to cut 100,000 people maximum from, you know, the Army and the Marine Corps. Well, we added 100,000 to fight the war. We're out of Iraq. We're on our way out of Afghanistan. Why wouldn't you do it?
Yeah, but, you know, here locally, I opened up the newspaper and there's an article, you know, in there saying, these cuts are going to have a ripple effect, in central Pennsylvania. We could lose, you know, something to the, you know, the local airport and Fort Indiantown Gap. And, it could be a catastrophe. We could lose jobs.
And again, if you're interested in jobs, defense is the least effective way to create jobs. We've done studies, you know, at our place and other economists, you know, have looked at that. And basically, if you, you know, want to create, you know, use government spending to create jobs, you know, education and health is the best. Defense is the worst. Or if you just want to reduce the deficit, that creates more jobs than defense spending.
So let me ask you this, Larry. I've been hearing John McCain and a lot of other people saying, you know, the president, he's leading from behind. And, these cuts, you know, kind of play into that frame. You know, he doesn't really believe in the military. He's going to cut the military. He's going to make us weak, all around the world.
Well, you know, and again, if, you know, as Obama pointed out yesterday, even after these cuts, okay, he'd be spending more again in real terms than when Bush left office, because in his first 3 years, he raised defense spending. People forget that. And he raised it more than Bush had projected. I looked, you know, in Bush's last year, he projected by fiscal 12, which is the fiscal year we're in right now, defense spending would be 544. You know what Obama asked for? 553.
Wow.
So, I mean, yeah, I mean, you get this reputation. And you know, when you look behind it, it's simply not true.
Sounds like a good place for deficit reduction, or you know what, maybe helping create jobs, maybe to rebuild our infrastructure.
Right. And I thought it was, and you had the quote from Eisenhower there. You know why Eisenhower gave that speech that you quoted? Because after the Soviets launched Sputnik, people in this country panicked. And they wanted to increase defense spending. Now, he was able to hold it down because of his stature and, you know, what he did in World War II. But the country panicked and, you know, actually it was the Democrats back then that said it was weak on defense, bomber gaps and missile gaps. And so they increased defense spending by the Congress over his objections. That's why he gave that speech, because he knew that it wasn't true that the Soviets, yes, they launched Sputnik, but they didn't have more missiles and bombers or anything than we had. We had more.
Right. And, you know, I keep asking the question, how many more nuclear weapons do we need? How much more of this stuff do we need?
Well, again, you know, you take it nuclear weapons. We have 5,000 operations. We have 5,000 weapons, okay? The Air War College, the Air Force, not some liberal think tank, has done a study. So how many do we really need for deterrence? 311. Okay, you got 5,000.
Right.
And right now, if you don't do anything, you're going to have to build a whole new generation of submarine launch ballistic, you know, submarine launched, you know, missiles to launch ballistic missiles from submarines, bombers, and land-based missiles. You know, that could cost you $500 or $600 billion over the next decade.
Wow. So let me ask you this. I've been seeing an awful lot of stuff going on in Iran, and this is kind of takes us in a different direction. But to me, I was driving in today, and I keep hearing about Iran and the Straits of Hormuz, and then I didn't even really know they had a navy, which I guess tells you how dumb I can be sometimes. But yeah, I'm seeing all this saber rattling, and I'm listening to all of this talk about Iran. Kind of reminds me when I was a kid back in the late 70s. How much of this is real, actual truth, and is there any part of it that could be tied to these cuts, to where we say, oh, well, you know, we can't make these cuts right now because, you know, this thing in Iran, you know, we need to take on that too at some point.
Well, first of all, you're not going to send ground troops into Iran. We saw what happened when you sent them into Iraq, you know, to try, you know, and Iran is more than twice as big. If you were to use action, it would be your Navy. We have the Fifth Fleet is in Bahrain, which is right near the Straits of Hormuz. You know, the Iranians basically, they're upset that the sanctions are finally beginning to bite. And the defense bill that was passed this year gives the president the authority to make them even tougher by sanctioning the bank. In other words, Iran's central bank saying anybody who does business with them can't do business with the United States, which would completely devastate their economy. So they're threatening, okay, you guys do that, we're going to close the Straits of Hormuz. First of all, it would hurt them more than us because how's their oil going to get? Where are they going to get any money? And you know, they did try to fool around with us once back in the 80s and we cleaned their clocks, you know. I mean, yeah, they have speedboats and things like that, but they don't have aircraft carriers or anything.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I mean, I'm like, you know, are you really going to be able to take out? I didn't think so, but it reminded me of, you know, at that time back in the late 70s, early 80s, where, you know, they were acting up again. And part of me said, you know, they're acting like North Korea. They act up a little bit. Maybe we send them a signed basketball in some movies like we had done with Kim Jong Il.
Yeah, well, they're very smart from their point of view. By threatening to close the Strait of Hormuz, drove the price of oil up. Who benefits? They do, because that's their main, you know, source of revenue.
And I go back to a national security point. Shouldn't we be getting off the fossil fuel at some point?
Oh, sure, we did. You know, Jimmy Carter tried to tell us that, and we just have not done it. And every time people come up with these studies and stuff like that, people say, "Oh no, if you drill under the water, or you know, get it out of the mountains, you know, and you know, well, eventually we can do it." No, we're still dependent on foreign oil, and you know, until we do, it's going to be hard for us to have the policy we'd like. Why do we have to ignore what the Saudis do? Because they're our gas station.
Excellent point. So with this whole thing going on in Iran, where are we doing the right thing? Because I keep hearing my righty friends going, well, you know, he's weak. He's letting them get away with all this stuff. I hear Santorum saying he would bomb them, and you got all this heated rhetoric. Are we on the right track there?
Oh, sure. I mean, first of all, the Iranians learned from when the Israelis destroyed Saddam Hussein's reactor in Osirik in 1981. They've spread it out. They've got it on the ground. You're not going to get it. And what you would do, first of all, then you would unite the people because, while there's a lot of disagreement there, the one thing they agree on is that we have no business messing in their affairs. And basically, then they have some weapons that they could unleash against us with, you know, some of their proxies like Hezbollah and Hamas. They could cause all kinds of trouble for, you know, in Iraq, you know, if in fact we, you know, we did that. So if you look at it from a cost-benefit thing, it makes no sense. And no, you don't want them to get nuclear weapons. If people say, well, they're crazy. You know, in the 60s, when Mao Zedong got nuclear weapons, you know what he said? I'd like to have a nuclear exchange. I'll lose a couple hundred million people. I'll still have a billion. How about you guys? And people, actually the Soviets or the Russians wanted to us to get together to take them out. But, you know, we decided not to, and, you know, we live with it. And, you know, nobody's going to use nuclear weapons. They get one or two. We got 5,000.
Right. You know, because that's going to be the next week, I think, we're going up to New Hampshire for the primary, and I think that's going to be one of the hot-button issues that they're going to want to talk about. And I know the Republicans are going to come out with this, well, we need to be tough on defense, and we need to do this and show our strength. And I'm going, yeah, but sometimes that doesn't work. What happened to walk softly and carry a big stick? Where's the walk softly part?
Well, I mean, you know, basically, you should be willing to negotiate. I mean, Admiral Mullen, who just stepped down as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said, I'd like to be able to talk to the Iranians in case something goes on here. We want to know, and, you know, the misunderstanding in the Straits of Hormuz or something like that. I mean, we had a hotline with the Soviet Union during the Cold War.
Yep.
I mean, they had 40,000 nuclear weapons. Okay. 40,000.
Wow.
But we had a hotline and we talked to them.
Yeah.
And you're too young to remember. I was, you know, in the Navy, when the Cuban Missile Crisis happened, you know, hey, I mean, that was serious business.
And times I don't want relived.
Yes.
So, and bringing that up, I looked at China. I mean, I think they're our biggest adversary, and we like to take a tone that they're really not, that they're trading partners, but I got to be honest, I'm concerned.
Well, again, China is not an expansionist power like the Soviet Union was. The Chinese obviously have their interest, and, you know, they want to safeguard them, and they want to, you know, protect what they see as their, you know, rights. And, you know, we got two big issues with them. One is Taiwan, and, of course, the other is, you know, the minimal rights in the South China Sea. But the interesting thing is the Chinese have gotten kind of aggressive. Now who's coming to us? The Vietnamese and all the people there, the Australians say, hey, we gotta get together to go against China, which in effect is gonna hurt China in the long run.
It's an interesting thought on that.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. When I was in government, President Reagan sent me to China in 1984 to help them modernize their military logistics system. I always think, oh, my goodness, we ever have a war with them, they're going to do better because of, you know, the efforts we did.
Because you did it. It's all going to be your fault.
Yeah, I know. Well, because then we were using them to balance against the Soviet Union.
Right. It's all in who your friends are today are the
That's
ones that are
right.
going to bite you in the behind tomorrow.
Well, that's right. I mean, the first thing I ever learned in international relations is nations don't have permanent friends or enemies. They have permanent interests.
Yep, exactly. So last question on this. In looking at these budget cuts, nothing really to worry about.
No, nothing to really worry about. And it's a good thing because it'll help us somewhat toward dealing with our deficit problem, which is the greatest threat to our national security.
Could he have gone further?
I think he could have. I think they're very, very moderate. You know, I think, and we've written some stuff, you could double them and really still, you know, be in an excellent position if you did them, you know, smartly.
And not jeopardize national security
no,
at all.
No.
Excellent. Excellent. Lawrence Korb, I appreciate the time. Senior fellow at the Center for American Progress.
Okay, good to talk to you.
Thanks so much. AmericanProgress.org, the website. Quick break, right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
The Rick Smith Show.
Congress. How small-minded is it? How tangled up in a right-wing ideological knot is it? How subservient to corporate lobbyists is it? The answer to these three questions are pizza, tomato paste, and spuds. At a time when doctors and nutritionists are sounding a national alarm about a diabetes epidemic caused by gross obesity, including in children, the Congress of the United States of America, in all of its majesty, has killed an effort by the Agriculture Department to make school lunches healthier. Why? Three reasons. One, Congress is incapable of meeting America's big needs, so it's rationalizing its existence by messing with the small stuff. Two, Congress's right-wing ideologues are so batty that they even oppose federal rules to improve our children's health. Three, and most significant, the French fry lobby, tomato paste lobby, and frozen pizza lobby put big bucks into congressional campaigns and they pulled the strings of our lawmakers. So the financial interests of corporate powers, including Coca-Cola, ConAgra, and Del Monte, have overridden the interests of America's school kids. Yet, members of Congress still say they can't figure out why their public approval rating has crashed to an all-time low of 9%. Nine. Good grief. As Senator Michael Bennett recently pointed out to his colleagues, oil giant BP, at the height of its disastrous contamination of our Gulf, held on to a 16% approval rating. The IRS gets a 40% rating on its job performance. And even the idea of America becoming communist draws 11% support. This is Jim Hightower saying, the real question is, who makes up the 9% that approve of this Congress? I'm guessing they're relatives, staffers, and the two Koch brothers. Plus, of course, corporate lobbyists.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So, Rick Santorum on the stump up in Northfield, New Hampshire. Town hall meeting talking about the military. He said, I grew up around veterans. I grew up around, you know, folks who love their country. Folks who serve their country. He said, I didn't see working in government service and being in politics as anything but serving your country and doing in some ways, in a civilian sense, what a lot of folks did in a military sense. He said, I saw it as something that is honorable and good to do. And, you know, I'll buy that for, I do believe public service is honorable. I think it's good. I don't know that I compare it to military service so much, but I guess that's how you take that hard line, we should bomb everybody approach, and still kind of give yourself some credibility. He goes on to say the rest of the country doesn't function unless the government keeps us free. Let me say that again, because I didn't think a Republican would say that. He said the rest of the country doesn't function unless the government keeps us free. That doesn't sound like a conservative thing to say, does it? I know that's what he believes, and I do believe that government service is, I do believe it is a noble profession. At times it can be sleazy because of the game of how it's been set up and the position that people are in quite often to continue to get elected. But, you know, there's part of me that says, yeah, okay. And we need government. We need government to function so that you have, you know, education, so that you have infrastructure, so that you have a baseline. I'm right there with him. But I don't know how that's going to play up in New Hampshire. Because he's done a lot of dumb things up there. I don't know. You know, his shining moment in the sun, not going so well. Not going so well at all. So when we go up there, I'm hoping he sees that we're from Pennsylvania. He stops by because I'd love to talk to him. I don't even know that I would talk about the gay thing. I think he's getting beat up enough over the gay thing. And a little bit later in the show, we'll talk a little bit about the insanity that was his 15-minute rant on, and I'm still trying to figure it out. But his 15-minute rant on gay issues. But it's his manufacturing policies that I'm interested in. Really all of their manufacturing policies. You know, it's one thing to say, yes, I want to bring manufacturing back, but under what conditions? Do we want to bring manufacturing back the way it was in the 50s? Do we want to bring those jobs back from China and allow them to act as they did, as they do in China? I don't think so. But they do. Because that's their rhetoric, isn't it? Deregulate. Cut taxes? Isn't that how they keep telling? Leave business alone? Let them do what they want? You know, going back to the good old days? Maybe the days of liberty of contract where before you get hired, you sign that you'll never join a union or you'll get fired? I mean, we've already taken workers' rights away through the Supreme Court.
The Roberts Court already took your rights away. If you sign on the dotted line before you get hired that you can't sue them in court, you have to take them to an arbitrator of their choosing. You don't get hired unless you sign it. Your rights have already been taken away from you, and you don't even know it. The same thing's done when you sign a contract, like with your cell phone company or somebody else. You can't sue them. You can't enter into a collective, into a class action suit and sue them, because you've got to sue them individually, and you have to take them through a mediator or arbitration. But most people don't know that. And yet we want corporations to be people. The idea is, oh boy, you know, corporations are just like people. In fact, Mitt Romney said it. He said, oh, corporations are people, my friend. So Huntsman, John Huntsman's trying to pick up a little spot. He was in Concord, New Hampshire, taking aim at Romney's, you know, stating that corporations are people. And Huntsman said, of course corporations are not people. Who would say such an outlandish thing? I think the entire Republican Party. John, buddy. You're in the wrong ticket. You're in the wrong arena, which is why he's running so poorly in the polls, which is why he's so far down in the polls, because he's really not one of them, and they know he's not one of them. They believe wholeheartedly, 100%, corporations are people because they distribute money to their people, the people at the top, not you and me. And you look at the story that came out this week. You know, corporate profits are back, man. They're pre-recession levels. But what they're paying to Uncle Sam, what they're paying to support our community, they're paying to support this country, nowhere close. And you know, pre-recession, they paid $380 billion in taxes. Last year, $200 billion. Where's that $180 billion? Profits are back. It's like it was for them before the recession. You know who it's hurting? It's hurting us. So that $180 billion, where did that go? Well, it went to them, man. This is called redistribution of wealth. This is taking money out of your pocket, my pocket, every working person in this country's pocket, and putting it in theirs, which is why they want the Romneys, which is why they want the corporatists. Which is why Santorum, when he's not bashing gays and talking about abortions, he's talking about how do we bring back business. But he's not talking about how do we create good paying jobs. How do you bring back manufacturing? Because we need to have those employers here so they can profit, so they don't have to ship their goods so far. They can save on shipping costs. So we're going to import poor labor conditions. We're going to import environmental degradation. That's the Republican platform, my friends. More Boeing. We want more Boeing. And, you know, I talked about it yesterday in Wichita, Kansas, where, you know, they're going to shut down this plant that's been there for more than 80 years. It has been an anchor of the community. One of the guys that they quoted in it said, you know, you can't find a person in this town who hasn't worked there or knows somebody who works there. 7,500 jobs gone. And if you remember, and for it was a couple years, this whole thing started back in, I think, 2004, with the argument over who gets the in-flight, the air tanker refueling contract. And what got me, you know, I go back to that. I was thinking about this last night. What I remember this whole debate, which was, Airbus had never made one of these in-flight refueling tankers. They didn't even have the technology. They don't know how to make it. So we were going to have to give them the technology. We were going to have to teach them how to build it, which is dumb on our part, that you're going to give a foreign company your technology on, you know, from just a national security standpoint. It's dumb to be giving that technology away. But beyond that, they promised, if you do this, you give us the contract, we'll build a final assembly plant. You know, we'll put it together in Alabama. So you have the senators and the whole congressional delegation from Alabama fighting for Airbus. Think about this for a second. Fighting for a foreign company to get a government contract for the military just because they were going to build a plant in their state. Stop and think about the radical self-interest that goes into that. So when I hear people talk about states' rights, I think of that every once in a while. I think of Zach Womp in Tennessee going, well, you know, Volkswagen, they just built a plant in Tennessee. Granted, we gave them $1 billion. And, of course, wages and benefits and everything else are lower than anywhere else in the country. Stop and think about what that means to the direction of the nation. You know, when my kid comes home and my kindergartner is thrilled that he knows the Pledge of Allegiance and he loves standing up, he loves saying the Pledge of Allegiance, and, you know, I'm proud that he does. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. Not to Tennessee, not to Kansas, not to Washington or South Carolina, the entire country. Because we are one nation. Or did we forget that? I know we talk about it, the whole one nation thing. And we love to say the under God part. But one nation. So when I look at this story with Boeing, it just drives me insane. And the whole setup stinks. Quick break, right back after this.
A boy with a gun. I got a picture in my pocket of the lucky one. I announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. It is my business hat. I'm on to 1 a.m. I must tell you that. I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
We think of the planet Mars as a world much like Earth. Both worlds orbit in the inner solar system, and they're similar in size.
But Mars might have developed very soon after the birth of our solar system, while Earth is thought to have formed much later. 4.5 billion years ago, a disk of gas and dust is thought to have surrounded the early sun. Within the disk, kilometer-sized chunks of material called planetesimals collided to form the embryos of the planets we know today.
Earth is thought to have developed as late as 100 million years after the solar system began to form through a series of continued collisions. On the other hand, Mars might have stopped growing at its embryo stage only about 2 million years after the solar system began to take shape. If that's so, it would explain why Mars is the runt among inner worlds of our solar system and why its geology is profoundly different from that of Earth.
Astronomers refine the age of Mars by using carbon dating on Martian meteorites. So Earth formed through a series of collisions over tens of millions of years. But Mars may be a solitary embryo, a world that did not undergo continuous collisions. To learn more, come to EarthSky.org and search for Mars Embryo. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Bird. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
A great game rocks in the hot sun. I cross the law and the law one. I cross the law and the law one.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. Question, comment, something on your mind, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. You can email me anytime. You know, I look at, again, I go back to that whole thing with Boeing, and it just drives me insane. This idea that we've got representatives in this country with their own radical self-interest for their very narrow special interest. And the country, well, everybody else be damned, I guess. But I look at this case that's going to be heard, I guess, in the Supreme Court next Wednesday, if I'm not mistaken. It's Coleman versus Maryland Court of Appeals. This guy Coleman, he got sick, as any of us could. decided his doctor said you need some bed rest. He said, I need to take some family leave time. They fired him. It's as simple as that. And it was ruled against him. Now on to the Supreme Court. Here to talk a little bit about it and tell us what's going on. And her name is Vicki Shabo. She is the Director of Work and Family Programs at the National Partnership for Women and Family. Vicki, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you for having me, Rick.
You know, I look at this, the Family Medical Leave Act. It's something that I've used in the past. When my children were born, I was able to take some time off to welcome them into the world. And to me, it is this piece of legislation, while it's unpaid, still one of those family value things that folks love to talk about.
You know, it really is. The FMLA has been used more than 100 million times. By people all across America for their own health, to address their own health condition, to take care of a sick family member, or, as you mentioned, to take care of a new child or adopted child. It really is fundamental to the protections that we enjoy in this country and essential to us being able to take care of ourselves and our families.
Yeah, I would love to see it be a paid time off. If you really believed in family values, you'd extend it to more people by not having that that loss of income for that time being part of it. But that's a whole discussion for another day.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
You know, the discussion here is this guy says, look, I'm sick. My doctor says I need bed rest. He goes to his employer, which I guess is the state of Maryland, and they told him, there's the door.
Right. Yeah, so Daniel Coleman was a chief procurement officer for the Court of Appeals. He had been there for 6 years. He requested 2 weeks of medical leave based on his doctor's orders for 2 weeks of bed rest to address his diabetes and his hypertension, and within 4 hours he was asked to resign. The next day he received an official termination letter, and he's never actually received any official explanation from the state as to why he was terminated. He did, however, have 6 years of positive performance reviews and no indication that he was in danger of losing his job up until the time that he asked for his FMLA time off.
So let me ask you, because I honestly don't know. Is Maryland an at-will employment state?
Well, Mr. Coleman is, I don't know whether he was covered by a union contract, but he asserted his rights under the Family and Medical Leave Act. And that law, as it's written and as we've understood it for nearly 20 years now, applies to both private sector and public sector employees, regardless of any terms that might be in there.
So where's the rift here? I mean, I mean, look, the doctor's note to me would have been enough. You're sick. You need to take some time off to take care of yourself. The language to me seems pretty clear. Why is
right.
this different?
So the actual issue before the court is whether Congress intended to address unconstitutional sex discrimination when it enacted the Family and Medical Leave Act, and such that states could be sued by their employees for violations of their FMLA rights. And in 1993, the court decided under the family care provisions of the Family and Medical Leave Act, so that's leave to care for a sick spouse or parent or leave to care for a new child, the court decided in a 5-4 decision that Congress did intend to allow states to be sued. The issue here is that the District Court in Maryland and the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals have held that Congress did not intend for states to be sued for workers who are asserting their own right to take family leave for their own medical condition.
So if I'm hearing you right then, they're arguing that they can't be sued for breaking the law.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. And where do you think this is going to go with the court?
Well, we fully expect that the court will follow its decision in Hibbs and that we'll find that the same rationale applied, that there was ample evidence for Congress to, in legal terms, abrogate state sovereign immunity, in layman's terms, allow states to be sued because of its power under the 14th Amendment to remedy unconstitutional discrimination.
But you know, the lower court ruled against him, right?
That's right, and it's baffling to us why the court would have held that. There's ample evidence in the congressional record, and it was clear congressional intent that that unconstitutional discrimination was happening both in the private sector and in the public sector, and that Congress intended the law to cover both private and public sector employees for all of the purposes covered by the law.
Yeah, I hope you're right, and I hope your confidence is on the money, because, you know, I look at the Roberts Court, and anything that has to do with helping workers, I got to be honest, the cases I've been following, I'm not that positive on.
Yeah, there have been a couple of exceptions to that, but you know, we really do just hope that the court will do the right thing, will honor the principle of stare decisis, which means following their prior decisions, and will hold that state employees are able to sue the state when their FMLA rights are violated. There are about 5.3 million state employees nationwide, and we estimate that about 500,000 take leave under the FMLA for their own serious health condition each year. So this decision, you know, has a serious impact and could impact millions of employees, and we are confident and very hopeful that the court makes the right decision here.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Vicki Szabo. She's the Director of Work and Family Programs at the National Partnership for Women and Families. You know, what happens if, you know, and heaven forbid it goes the wrong way, what happens if they rule against Mr. Coleman? I mean, obviously, he's going to lose his job and his claim, but what's it going to mean to every state worker across this country?
It means that every state worker would be relying on their own state. There are many states, about 20 states, have their own Family and Medical Leave Act. There are other provisions in state law that protect public sector workers, but in states where those laws aren't on the books or where the protections under state law are not as good as the federal FMLA, those workers would be left quite vulnerable in the case of their need to take FMLA leave.
And for me, you know, one of these things you'd said earlier, you didn't know if he was covered under a union contract or not. I would take a venturing guess to say he probably was not. But this is, to me, highlights another reason why I think public sector workers need to be covered under union contracts, because a lot of times this kind of stuff is addressed in those contracts.
Absolutely. That's a very good point.
And, you know, I look at my own experience. The company I work for, they wanted to deny me the ability to go and take a couple of weeks to spend with my children when they were born. And it was right there in black and white. There was no getting around it, which is why I'm a big fan of employment contracts. CEOs have them. Why shouldn't workers?
Absolutely. But, you know, the fundamental principle in this case is that this is a basic workplace protection that should be extended to all eligible workers across the country, whether they work for a private sector or a public sector employer, and whether they're covered by a union contract or not.
Excellent point. Excellent point. So I guess this is going to be Wednesday. When do you think we'll get a decision on this?
As you said, oral argument is on Wednesday, and we will have a decision before the end of the court's term in June.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to that, and we'll ask you back to come talk to us about the decision, if you don't mind.
That sounds great. I would look forward to that.
Thanks so much, Vicki.
Vicki
Szabo, Director of Work and Families Program at the National Partnership for Women and Families. Let's take a quick break. Right back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
It is believed that a little hard work is good for the soul. If this is true, then the history of child workers in the United States is a soulful tale. The first child laborers landed in Virginia in the year 1619. These immigrant children found slave working conditions and poverty wages in their new world. As the years passed, little changed. The average child worker toiled 16 to 18 hours per day, 6 days a week in factories and textile mills. Education was a luxury, and many believed a loss on working children. Charles Harding, president of the Merchants Woolen Company, stated, "There is such a thing as too much education for working people sometimes. I have seen cases where young people are spoiled for labor by too much refinement." Labor unions, consumer groups, and parent coalitions all work to shorten hours, ease conditions, and ultimately end exploitive child abuses. Baby strikes in Paterson, New Jersey, and Allentown, Pennsylvania, demanding 11 and 12-hour workdays, were fought vehemently by mill and factory owners. The Pennsylvania legislature was the first to consider prohibiting child workers in 1833. And consider is all Pennsylvania did until July of 1903, when Mother Jones led the March of the Mill Children from Philadelphia to Oyster Bay, New York, in an attempt to influence President Theodore Roosevelt. In 1836, Massachusetts was the first state to pass a law restricting the use of children in manufacturing. And 102 years later, the United States Supreme Court ruled the Walsh-Healy Act restricting the use of child labor as constitutional. Also in 1938, Congress passed the Fair Labor Standards Act, which put more stringent stringent restrictions on the use of child labor. While hard work teaches discipline, self-reliance, and responsibility, the exploitive nature of our past must remind us that what we have today, we mustn't take for granted, for the days of tomorrow are doomed to repeat if we ignore those lessons hard learned. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
The third agency of government, yeah. I would do away with the education, the commerce, and let's see, I can't. The third one, I can't. Sorry. Oops.
Yeah, you know what I love about that clip? If you listen to Ron Paul, you can hear him go like, ugh. You can hear the disgust in his voice. That here he's standing on the same stage with this doofus. I mean, really, you could feel the air just coming out of him like, ugh. Do I look like an idiot standing next to him or what? And then he was nice enough to say, hey, you know, here, take my ideas. Here, take some of my bad ideas. Make them your own. Amazing. Amazing stuff. I wonder, you know, there's this goat. I saw this story. There's this guy who has a goat. His name's Bill Higgins. He owns this goat that I guess every election season he brings his goat out and makes the candidates interact with the goat. And my first thought is, why in the hell would you go near a goat? If I were running for president, the guy said, come on over to my goat and see how my goat takes to you, and I'll vote for you. I'd be going, I don't want your vote. You're insane. But Newt Gingrich and John Huntsman, they I guess, went. I guess most of them have gone. According to Higgins, Gingrich and Huntsman have gotten the best response from Isaac the goat. Because Bill says, you know, I watch his body language and his temperament toward the candidates, you know. I watch the goat. And, you know, his hair gets all prickly, then we know there's something wrong. But if no hair, you know, standing on his back, that's a good sign. And if they back away, then forget it. I don't want to talk to them because they don't want goats. And, you know, as soon as I read this story, I thought of the classic Alan Combs clip. And, you know, while I generally don't like to play other talk show hosts' bits, this is absolutely a classic. This guy, Neil Horsley, who is now a big right-wing lunatic, big Christian lunatic, if you will, runs for something all the time. I think he ran for Congress in Georgia a couple of years back. But it's just classic. You got to hear this.
By the way, it also points out that in Esquire magazine interview, you acknowledged taking part in homosexual sex and bestiality in the 70s.
That's my point, Alan. I mean, just
is that
because,
true?
Because it's printed in the news media or on the internet, everybody is jumps to believe it. But in reality, if I say the truth,
is that true?
People say that's not. Hey, Alan, if you want to accuse me of having sex when I was a fool, I did everything that crossed my mind that looked
yes,
like it might
you,
feel good.
You had sex with animals?
As an active hedonist, absolutely. I was a fool.
You had sex with animals?
Oh, when you grow up on a farm in Georgia, and your first girlfriend is a mule.
I'm not so sure that
is
so.
That's because you didn't grow up on a farm in Georgia. Did you?
Are you suggesting that everybody who grows up on a farm in Georgia has a mule as a girlfriend?
I'm saying that it has historically been the case. You people are so far removed from the...
Look, I'll admit, Neil, I'm a city boy. I don't know a lot about growing up on a farm.
Hello, welcome to domestic life on the farm.
But I think for you to say, there are a lot of people listening to you right, Neil, there are a lot of people listening to me right now who live on farms, are raising kids on farms, who grew up on farms, and I don't think they're dating Elsie right now. You know what I'm saying?
The fact of the matter is, don't know that in fact you experiment with anything that moves when you're growing up sexually, it's you're naive and you know better than that. You know yourself. If it's warm and if it's damp and it vibrates, you might in fact have sex with it.
No,
that is the absolute best line in the history of anything. If it's warm and it vibrates. You might just, according to Neil Horsley, you may just have sex with it, which is kind of interesting, you know, when you talk about Rick Santorum. Because he's got this thing on his mind, you know, the whole, he's a big, every time you hear him talk, he's talking about bestiality or homosexuality. And as I've said for the longest time, you know, he's not going to make it. That man on dog don't hunt. He ain't happening. And, you know, it's one of those things where I've always believed, and maybe you disagree, but I've always believed the person who's projecting, the person who's pointing the finger, the guy who's doing it. You know, it's like the guy who passes gas in the elevator and goes, "Who did that?" You know, it was him. It's the same thing with this. You know, the guy who's pointing his finger going, you, he's the one worrying about doing it, which is why we see so many of these right wingers who, you know, I go back to Bob Allen. And I'll, as long as I live, I will never forget Florida State Legislator Bob Allen, who every year while he was in the Florida State Legislature proposed a piece of legislation that if you propose to have sex in a men's bathroom or in a park or anything like that, and it's if you propose to a guy in a bathroom or whatever, $1,000 fine, year in jail. That's what he proposed. It never passed, but every year he'd propose it. And then, you know, on one rainy day and dark over clouds, and, you know, because in Florida the rain can be pretty brutal. He saw the rain coming in. He runs into a men's bathroom, and there, a very large black man, scared by the rain. This is his defense. Scared by the rain and the thunder, you know, because thunder is very scary. And of course, afraid of this very large black man. He then offered the black man to perform certain acts on him in the bathroom, and then give him money. And you know, I've been thinking about that, and I go, you know, I don't know that would be my first thought. I don't know that I would really think of that. No, I don't think that would ever enter in my mind. I'm afraid. So here, let me. No, but that's what he did. That was his defense, and he stuck to it. Fortunately, he lost. But you know, it's that mindset. You know, it's a lot of them. You remember what was his name? Ted, Pastor Ted. Remember Pastor Ted? I think I know what you did last night. If you give me $1,000, I won't tell your wife. Remember him? You know, the big evangelical right-wing minister who said, well, you know, we're going to go after every piece of legislation we can find. And it turns out there he is sniffing crack off the backside of a male hooker. Really? But I guess, you know, I guess like Neil says, I guess if you grew up on a farm, your first girlfriend might be a cow. Who knows? But Santorum, he's really, honestly and truthfully, screwing his moment in the sun up. He did something today that I think is almost a cardinal sin. He had the audacity to go after Ronald Reagan. Ugh, I know. I'm amazed. The audacity to say that the Social Security crisis is because Reagan kicked the problem down the road. Instead of dealing with them head on back in 1983, he had a bipartisan fix that kicked the can 20 years down the road. And he said, you know, it was masterful. It was brilliant politicking. Because you push it off down the road, and you know, you can claim victory today, and 20 years down the road, somebody else will be responsible. It's brilliant, he says. And I stopped and I thought about that for a minute. Isn't that exactly what they're talking about doing with the retirement age? Proposing it 20 years down the road, saying, well, we'll raise it in 20 years so they don't have to take the political heat for it. Because in 20 years, most people have forgotten it was them or they'll be dead by then, one or the other. But I look at this and I go back to that fix where they came up with the idea of the trust fund that we were going to pay all this money in because the baby boom generation was so large that we couldn't have a pay-as-you-go system. We had to actually take in some revenue and hold on to it to be able to pay out, which was a very smart thing. Personally, what should have happened is they shouldn't have capped it. They should have lowered the rate and they should have taken it all the way to the top. Again, telling you what the rich and the very wealthy, the kind of power that they have. Because I got to tell you, every penny I've ever made in my life, every dime I've ever earned, I've paid Social Security tax on. every dime. I've never made more than $100,000 a year. It's actually $106,800 right now. So I've paid on every single penny. And explain to me why a guy who's making his living betting on Wall Street, why he doesn't have to pay. He could make $4 billion a year like the guy, like that Tepper guy who made the right bet. And he doesn't have to even pay the $106,800 to Social Security. Because that's capital gains, which is different than you people who work for a living, you workers. You workers, you have to pay. I say every penny of income should be taxed as income, regardless of how you get it. Regardless of how it ends up in your bank account, it should be taxed the same. And that means Social Security as well. In fact, we removed the cap. That's the answer to our problems. That's the answer. And if there is a problem. Now, they're projecting outward, you know, 30 years into the future, it's going to pay every penny pretty much for the entire baby boom generation, which is what it was supposed to do. Now, had you paid back all that money that was stolen during the 80s and 90s, especially the 80s, during the Reagan years, because understand, he took that money in, put it into the general operating budget to hide his massive deficits. He wanted his Star Wars, he wanted his bread and butter too. So he had to hide those huge budget deficits by taking money from the Social Security Trust Fund to cover it up. That's reality. I'd love to hear a Republican say that. You can't even get Eric Cantor to say that Reagan raised taxes during his time in office, which he did 11 times. But we can't talk about that. But I'm waiting to see what the fallout is over this. I'm waiting to see what the Republicans in New Hampshire do, because they've turned Reagan into this deity. They've turned him into this iconic figure that did no wrong. Granted, they've forgotten Iran-Contra, they've forgotten all the tax raising, they've forgotten all the wasteful spending, they've forgotten all the corruption, more people in jail than any administration, forgotten all that. St. Reagan, well, actually, I think he was probably out of it for most of the term, to be honest with you. And that's not ripping on him, that's the scourge that is Alzheimer's, and I wish it on nobody. But on a realistic tone, he was exhibiting those signs at the time. But when he said, I don't recall, 197 times while testifying, or whatever it was, as I sat and watched him testify, I truly believe he didn't, even though his signature, his handwriting was all over things. And now we find out after the fact, after everybody's gone, Ollie North came out and wrote it. Reagan knew it all. But we don't even want to believe that, because St. Reagan would have never done that. But it's going to be interesting to see what the Republicans do with Tricky Ricky, because you really can't get away with that in the Republican Party. You cannot bash the good Reagan, which is why, again, another one of those moments of political calculus that you got to question his ability to be president, because you can't blurt dumb stuff out. Like when he was at New England College for their forum. Someone asked him about gay marriage. He went into some really bizarre discussion about why he would build a bridge and having to explain building bridges and why. And basically saying, and this is really the weird argument he's got. His argument is, as well, the gay people want it, so they have to explain why it's good for society. Because for 230 years in this country, according to Tricky Ricky, a man and a woman marriage is how things have been. And I said, well, you know, if things are wrong, you fix them because they're wrong, not because that's the way we've always done it. Right? I mean, at some point, I mean, you may not be into it. I'm not. But it's, why should one person have protection under the law while someone else doesn't? Why should someone have legal access to something that everyone doesn't? And then he got into some, you know, someone posed that question. And he got into some weird, so we should allow polygamy? He got into some, so we should do this, and we should. It's kind of a strange argument. But it is the Rick Santorum way. It is what gets, what what I think is going to ultimately bring him down, because the rational people in this country are going to look at Rick and go, you know, you're a bit too extreme. And he is. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this with Dave Promised. He's a steward out at local Teamsters Local 764 out in Milton. Quick break.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with a heart. The voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
This is WFTE 90.3 FM Mount Cobb and W289 AU 105.7 FM Scranton, Pennsylvania. Listen to us throughout Northeast Pennsylvania or check us out on the web at WFTE.org.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
We don't think it's an exaggeration to say that people could literally freeze to death in their homes as a result of this corporate decision.
USW Local 101 Vice President Jim Savage talking about possible home heating oil supply disruptions from the closing of three refineries in the Philadelphia area. Sunoco and ConocoPhillips plan to close three refineries and replace the product from those plants with imports. USW says losing these three refineries will also diminish the ability to make up losses in case Gulf Coast refineries are again disabled by hurricanes. USW Local 10234 President Dennis Stefano says that about 1,400 United Steelworker jobs will be destroyed, along with hundreds of building trades and management jobs, and local government and schools will lose millions of dollars. The union wants to keep the refineries open.
The very companies that are shutting down our refineries right now are the ones that are going to be importing, putting us out of work and replacing our good middle-class paying jobs with imported product. Before any more refineries are shut down in the United States, we absolutely believe Congress should require, absolutely require the CEOs, people making the decisions to close these refineries down, to come before Congress and explain why they're being shut down.
The attack is on the working people, and the attack is against collective bargaining, whether it's private or public workers. We're under attack right now.
International Longshore and Warehouse Union Local 21 President Dan Kaufman says his union is determined to fight the EGT company to the bitter end as the company tries to bust the ILWU at the Port of Longview in Washington State. Kaufman says the ILWU will meet a grain ship expected to come into the port soon in an effort to stop it from being loaded with non-union labor. ILWU and the local Central Labor Council in the Longview area have put out a labor call to action to make sure the ship is met by a massive protest. Kaufman says ILWU supported Wisconsin's worker uprising to defend public worker collective bargaining, and he vows ILWU will keep fighting the ongoing attacks on the union rights of workers.
The ILWU said, we've had enough. I know the people of Wisconsin said, we have had enough, and we're fighting back.
The Washington Education Association has won a lawsuit in which they accused the legislature of violating the Constitution by not properly funding the state's public education system. Jesse Russell reports.
The state Supreme Court ruled on Thursday that the legislature isn't doing enough and criticized the body for discussing reforms while making substantial cuts to education. Writing for the majority, Justice Deborah Stevens said the court wouldn't stand by as the legislature makes unfulfilled promises. The court has given lawmakers until 2018 to put reforms in place in an attempt to curtail what has become a pattern of moving the reform deadline further down the road. The ruling by the Washington State Supreme Court echoes a similar decision in 1978, which the court used as precedent for making such a demand of the legislature.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Question, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the broadcast, I download our podcast at the website. Or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app and take the program on the go. So again, you know, all week we've been highlighting companies that have been very profitable, and they turn around and say, you know what, we want big wage cuts, or we want benefit cuts, or we want more back from you. And it's been since the collapse, since September of 2008, it's been constant. All of the gains that workers have made over the last 40, 50 years Big business now sees the opportunity to take it back. And right now you've got more than 700 Teamsters who are pipeline construction workers. They're on strike right now after the Pipeline Contractors Association refused to come to an agreement, refused to negotiate on the contract. And I've got Mike Probst here, or Dave Probst here. He's a steward out at Local 764, the Teamsters out there in Milton, Pennsylvania, on the picket line. Dave, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you.
What's the major sticking issue here?
Major sticking issue, the PLCA don't want to sign with us. Their claimants are pension fund with Central States. They wanted us to start a new pension fund, which it cost millions of dollars, and it never would benefit the guys in the pipeline division right now.
Right.
We offered them to go to Minnesota Construction Benefits, pays 92% return, and they turned it down. The IBT has offered them quite a few different ways to solve this problem, but the bottom line is they just want to do is break the unions, get us out of there, and next year, about 3 years from now, when the other guys' contracts are up, the labor and the operators, or we'll break one of their unions too.
Now, you know, I look at some of the reading I've done on it. The big sticking point is, as I've seen it and you've articulated it, is they want to move you from a defined benefit plan into one of these 401ks. And again, you know, it's this shift of responsibility from the company and the union onto the backs of the individual. And, you know, I talk to people and I've got a 401k back during the collapse. That 401k turned into a 200.5 and I lost thousands of dollars. The reason that these companies want to do it is they want you and all of the people that work for you, work for them, they want them at risk.
Yep.
So yeah, how long have you been out on strike right now?
We struck January 1st. Our contract was up at midnight the 31st of December. And we've been striking in 798 Pipeline welders are standing behind us 100%. They're not crossing the line.
Good.
And don't look like you're going to cross the line.
Good.
But the operators, operating engineers, 542 has crossed the line, and 158 laborers has crossed the line. And they offered us work to go back to work across the picket line, but we're taking the $18 to $20 an hour pay cut to go back to work.
Wow. And again, you know, part of this is, I understand that this Pipeline Contractors Association, they're doing extremely well profit-wise.
Oh, yeah.
And this isn't about a struggling company. This is about them wanting more from you. This is about redistributing wealth from you back to them.
Yeah, they want more for their pocket and their stockholders. And I don't know why they won't come to agreement here. They won't even sit down and talk, the way I understand it, to come to agreement. So
what kind of pipeline are you building? Or were you building?
We're building, right now, I have worked all over the country for different contractors. But right now we're in the Marcellus Shale industry up here in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. And, we're building lines to hook these wells up and transmission lines to hook them to main lines so they can be shipped out and transported to other states.
Are you getting any help from the politicos in that region?
As of not right now, no, we haven't.
Yeah, because one of the things that frustrates me is they keep talking about we can't tax the Marcellus Shale. We've got to let that industry grow so they'll come and they'll create jobs. And I keep going, well, what kind of jobs? Are they going to be jobs that pay a decent living wage with decent health benefits or decent pensions? Or is it going to be one of these scenarios where, yeah, they brought in jobs, but they brought in jobs at minimum wage with no benefits and no opportunity?
Yeah.
And it sounds to me that that's what they're trying to do.
Yeah. There's a lot of jobs here, yes, but there's a lot, you know, a lot of these workers from out of town, travelers, I say, and like Cumming County, is making it rough for people to live here because the rent and staying here is so high, it's unreal for workers. You know, it's but you know the guy's still doing it because it's a different breed for pipeliners because you gotta love your work because if you don't, you won't make it out here.
Are there any negotiations going on right now? Are the union and the association talking at all?
I think they are. That's not official, but we heard they were talking a little bit.
Well, I wish you guys nothing but the best. Our thoughts are with you, and we hope that things get resolved quickly. And you know, one day more, brother.
Yeah, we're gonna give her our best. We're gonna be here every day at 5 o'clock, and we stay late at nights, and even when they're not working, we're here walking the picket line.
All right.
Stay,
well, try
to stay warm.
Stay warm, and I'd love to talk to you guys as this thing goes on. Thanks so much, Dave.
Oh, thank you. Have a good night.
You too. You know, I look at this, and again, we keep being told that, you know, we're going to create all these jobs. It's going to bring wealth to the region, and it is. You know, obviously, as he said, you know, things, the cost of everything is going up, but they don't want to pay their workers a decent living wage. And that's one of the things that I've talked about for some time. Look, I can put everybody back to work today. Everybody would be back to work today. Everybody would have a job. You'd make $1 an hour, but everybody would be back to work. And the question then becomes, what kind of an economy would you have? What kind of a nation would you have? What would your communities look like if everyone made $2 or $3 an hour? It'd all be slums. And we'd go back to the way things used to be, where you had two classes of people. You had the wealthy and the people who serviced the wealthy, and you had everybody else. Two classes. Which is what we're seeing happen again. And, you know, I love the argument, oh, we're a classless society, Rick. Didn't you know that? You can go sit in the same restaurant that Warren Buffett sits in. You can go have lunch next to Bill Gates. And I say, maybe I can, but I can't afford it. You know, if maybe I saved a year's salary for lunch, and they're ripping on Romney, and they're ripping on the other candidates because they spent $300 or $400 on a meal. That's a lot of money for average working people. I'll tell you, it's one of those things. But you know, sad this time of year, especially with the cold. I wish those guys nothing but the best of luck, because we've seen this all too often, where they want to switch from a defined benefits plan that give people some security in their retirement to one of these crappy 401ks that, well, puts you at the mercy of Wall Street. Quick break, right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back.
10% of the people own 90% of the wealth. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the wealth.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Congress. How small-minded is it? How tangled up in a right-wing ideological knot is it? How subservient to corporate lobbyists is it? The answer to these three questions are pizza, tomato paste, and spuds. At a time when doctors and nutritionists are sounding a national alarm about a diabetes epidemic caused by gross obesity, including in children, the Congress of the United States of America, in all of its majesty, has killed an effort by the Agriculture Department to make school lunches healthier. Why? Three reasons. One, Congress is incapable of meeting America's big needs, so it's rationalizing its existence by messing with the small stuff. Two, Congress's right-wing ideologues are so batty that they even oppose federal rules to improve our children's health. Three, and most significant, the French fry lobby, tomato paste lobby, and frozen pizza lobby put big bucks into congressional campaigns, and they pulled the strings of our lawmakers. So the financial interests of corporate powers, including Coca-Cola, ConAgra, and Del Monte, have overridden the interests of America's school kids. Yet, members of Congress still say they can't figure out why their public approval rating has crashed to an all-time low of 9%. Nine. Good grief. As Senator Michael Bennett recently pointed out to his colleagues, oil giant BP, at the height of its disastrous contamination of our Gulf, held on to a 16% approval rating. The IRS gets a 40% rating on its job performance. And even the idea of America becoming communist draws 11% support. This is Jim Hightower saying, the real question is, who makes up the 9% that approve of this Congress? I'm guessing their relatives, staffers, and the two Koch brothers. Plus, of course, corporate lobbyists.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving through their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com, the best place to go to get the podcast, or if you've got a smartphone, the Stitcher app. You can take the program on the go with you. So today in labor history, back on this day in 1916, 8,000 workers go on strike at the Youngstown Steel and Tube plant. The next day, their wives and family members joined them on the picket line, and guess what the company goons did? They bombed them with tear gas, they shot into the crowd, and they killed three of the workers and wounded 25 others. That's how things used to be done in this country. It used to be done with, first with billy clubs, then bullets. Now it's a lot more sterile. They use briefcases and lawyers. The results still the same. Also on this day in labor history, the year 1882, the Toronto Trades and Labor Council, they endorsed the principle of equal pay for men and women. 1882, they began the fight, and we see now, not over. So good news, the minimum wage has gone up in a number of states. Washington State surpassed $9 an hour, being one of the higher paying states in the country. A lot of areas have raised it up to $10 an hour. You've got, I guess it's Ohio, Arizona, Colorado, Florida, Montana, Oregon, and Vermont, who all had minimum wage increases on January 1st, pretty much sending the righties through the roof. The folks over at the Economic Policy Institute are saying, look, you know, what you're going to see is you're going to see a million people getting some benefit. You know, they're going to see their wages go up a little bit. They also say an additional 395,000 will see an increase indirectly from the minimum wage. And again, this is one of the reasons that you see the right going nuts about the minimum wage. It's going to raise the cost of labor for those poor people, and they don't care about the minimum wage. They don't care about the people at the bottom. They know it's going to jack everybody up a little bit more. They know the pressure is upward. And right now, especially during this time when they've really got the power to turn around and say, well, we want all that back. And which is why you're hearing states saying, well, we should be able to lower the minimum wage during tough times. And some places actually have an index where it can go down. I think Colorado was one of the states that had done that. But you're seeing, these states who have an indexing system, whereas, inflation goes up, so do the wages, which I think we should have done here in Pennsylvania. Now the righties, like I said, crazy. This article that I read though, really made me laugh because they said, raising the minimum wage is going to hurt, these businesses' profit thin margins, and it's going to force some of them to cut employee hours or raise the share of the employer provided health care. And I'm saying, if you're paying minimum wage, How many employers give their employees minimum wage and health care? I would say not an awful lot. I'm sure there are some, but not an awful lot. And would they raise the cost of their health care more than the raise they would have gotten in their checks? Interesting. And the other argument that they keep getting, and we've seen this before, it's all about, it's just high school kids. Ah, they're just teenagers. Just teenagers. And of the 1.4 million low-wage workers who are going to benefit from this minimum wage increase, they're saying about 80% of them are 20-plus. They're saying about 78% of them work at least 20 hours a week. So this idea that, well, it's just a kid who works one day on the weekend, it's not going to do anything. This is going to help put food on the table, and it's going to help folks make ends meet. And I'm all in favor of it. We should be minimum wage should be much higher. The minimum wage should be a minimum existence wage, not a minimum what you'll take wage. But we got our priorities a little backed up. But when it comes to the banking industry, we've got our priorities just right. You look at all these foreclosures going on. It's mind blowing. I saw this story. This guy had gone through the whole loan modification process. You know, he goes, I got my modification. I'm clear sailing from here on out. Problems are over. Bank of America lowered his monthly payment by, like $200. He was able to make the payment. They, lengthened the terms, of course, and did all that. So he went in to make his phone payment, because I guess you have to make your payments by phone. So he went in and he, went to make his payment. And he typed in 6158 or 61502. He should have typed in 61582. He didn't. Well, they wanted to foreclose on his house for 80 cents. Now, we've seen stories of them foreclosing on people's houses that weren't even there. We've seen them go after the wrong house. We've seen them, want to kick a 103-year-old woman out of her house. 80 cents. Wanted to kick them out. If you remember, they in New Jersey, there was a couple that they wanted to kick to the curb, just 2 days after they approved their loan modification. So I keep coming back to this place that they just want the property back, that they just want to foreclose on things. And it's not about wanting the property back. It's about wanting the insurance money. Cause, part of me buys into this theory that I've come up with that says, look, they're covered, man. They don't want short-term money coming in. They want the big chunks coming in. All those people who have PMI who are paying private mortgage insurance, to where if they default on their mortgage, the bank gets paid off. The bank's covered. And I look at these schemes that the banks come up with. And banks are masters at getting into your pocket. They're masterful at stripping money out of your pocket. I remember when I had a mortgage, they kept asking me, do you want to sign up for the biweekly advantage plan? It's only going to cost you $375. It's only going to cost you, it will only be a buck and a half transaction, twice a month, because it'll be biweekly. So you'll make two payments every month, and it'll help pay your mortgage, and you'll make an extra payment to pay your mortgage off faster. But it's going to cost you, over $400, per year. And the best part, for them anyway, is when you give them that first payment, they hold on to that until they get the second. And then they make your payment, because like Citibank, this city mortgage rule, they only make full payments once a month. So you're giving them your first payment. They're holding that for 2 weeks. And you make, it's only $400 or $500. But if you're multiplying that by, a million people, that's an awful lot of money. And that's an awful lot of interest, and that's an awful lot of in their pocket stuff. So when they're sitting on your money, they're happy as can be. And it's just amazing to me that people would sign up for that. I can't imagine anybody signing up for it. I remember every time they offered it to me, I said, no, I can make an extra payment myself every year. I can make a full payment, and I can hold on to my money just as easily as you can. And if I want to send a couple of bucks extra to pay it off, I can do that. But, you know, they make it sound so enticing. Oh, it'll be automatic. But it's a, there's a cost for that. $39 a year just to pay your mortgage on time? Amazing stuff. And you look at this story that's come out that they're saying that interest rates on credit cards, record high. It's more than 15% now since the recession has happened. You've seen the interest rates on credit cards go up to over 15%. And in some cases, you're seeing close to 30%. You know, the Visa Black Card has the highest penalty rate of 30.24%. And again, you know, I remember Bernie Sanders. Bernie wanted to cap interest rates at 30%. And the Republicans went ballistic. Absolutely went ballistic. Oh, we can't do that. That'll be the end of lending. Look, if you can't make it on 30% interest, there's a problem. There's an absolute problem. I don't know if you saw this today. Ben Bernanke came out with his solution for the housing crisis. It's pretty much the Romney plan. Rent out all those houses that are being foreclosed on. Have, you know, investors come in, suck up all those houses, and rent them back to the people who lost them. Now, I'm a big fan and have been a big fan of the idea of saying, okay, well, you know, all those people who are being foreclosed on, set up a quasi-government agency or, you know, private agency, whatever, and set it up to where those people get into a rent-to-own situation. All the money that they pay in rent goes on to the mortgage, and at a certain point, you know, down the road, it acts just like a mortgage. It's going to cost them a fee, as they would do paying interest, and people will be able to make money off that. But we want to keep people in their houses. We want to keep neighborhoods stable. We want to make sure that the empty houses get people in them. Sounds like a reasonable, rational idea to me. Something we probably should have thought of, oh, I don't know, right from the beginning. Which is kind of what I've been saying from the start. You can't let people get kicked out of their houses. You can't let these houses be abandoned and empty. Because then in come the people. You know, the people who take the furnace and the people who rip out the copper pipe and the people who rip out the chandeliers and the light fixtures and all the switches and the people who take anything of any value. And then what you're left with is an empty shell of a house that you have to tear down, like I saw on 60 Minutes a couple of weeks in my hometown. Is that good for society to have all these vacant homes? No. They're saying that now is the right time to do it because, well, all the rental properties are being sucked up. And all of the rental properties being sucked up is actually raising the price of rental properties. Because nobody can afford to buy a house, and nobody can really sell their house because the values, we're really in a very unusual spot. So the Romney plan, and, you know, probably the Bernanke plan as well, is we get these venture capitalists to come in, buy up a whole bunch of them, and rent them out. So basically a mega slumlord. So we need these mega slumlords to come in and stabilize and buy these houses up. And I'm saying, well, why can't we do this? So that the people who are in their homes can stay in their homes, pay rent. When they get back on their feet, you come up with some agreement that, you know, whatever you're paying, a portion of it goes to paying the mortgage off. Sounds rational to me. And then what you get is you get people who want to be in the house. And that, to me, is so important. Because you don't want to have a neighborhood full of renters. Because, you know, somebody who rents your place, they don't care what they do to it after they're gone. But again, it comes back to we need to have people who are forward-thinking. We need to have people who have good ideas. And all I keep hearing from the Romneys is, well, let's let the economy collapse. Let the vultures come in and eat up all of the profit. And that, I guess, you know, again, that's the way. I guess that's the Romney way. He did it with Bain Capital. You know, the very wealthy have been doing that from the beginning of time. Every time a working person gets a little bit ahead, you know, they pull the chain back a little bit. You know, it takes me back to the old company stores. As soon as you started getting a little bit ahead, well, they raised the production quotas or lowered your wages or raised the prices of everything at the company store or raised your rent. Amazing, amazing stuff. And I go back and I think about those, you know, as I've read about those days at the company store, I go, you know, are we much different today? You know, they give us credit cards. Is that much different than script? Is it much different than having to go to the company store? I got health insurance. It tells me I got to go to a provider that they say is okay, an approved provider. And if I don't, I got to pay in excess of what I would have paid otherwise. Is it much different? This illusion of freedom seems to be just that, kind of an illusion. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. Right back after this.
We want the world and we want it now. We're going to take it anyhow. We want the hell with
it. Not right wing. Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
We think of the planet Mars as a world much like Earth. Both worlds orbit in the inner solar system, and they're similar in size.
But Mars might have developed very soon after the birth of our solar system, while Earth is thought to have formed much later. 4.5 billion years ago, a disk of gas and dust is thought to have surrounded the early Sun. Within the disk, kilometer-sized chunks of material called planetesimals collided to form the embryos of the planets we know today.
Earth is thought to have developed as late as 100 million years after the solar system began to form through a series of continued collisions. On the other hand, Mars might have stopped growing at its embryo stage only about 2 million years after the solar system began to take shape. If that's so, it would explain why Mars is the runt among inner worlds of our solar system and why its geology is profoundly different from that of Earth.
Astronomers refined the age of Mars by using carbon dating on Martian meteorites. So Earth formed through a series of collisions over tens of millions of years. But Mars may be a solitary embryo, a world that did not undergo continuous collisions. To learn more, come to EarthSky.org and search for Mars Embryo. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Bird. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Well, on Monday, we will be live in New Hampshire. I'm looking forward to going into the land of the righties. And, well, I'm really not sure how they're going to look to me, because I'm going to union it up. I'm going to have all of my union wear on just to kind of just to see the look on their face. Kind of interesting. I've got Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service, on the line. Victoria, in New Hampshire, I understand.
I will be there, and you're going to behave with decorum. You are?
Of course I will. I've always been nothing but polite to insane people.
Good. That's how you're going to do it. That's the way to go.
Yeah, I don't have to like it.
Nobody ever said we had to like a lot of things in life.
There you go. Well, I want to see the reaction. I mean, you know, when you sit down and you talk to people and you say, look, my political leanings aren't right or left so much as they are, I'm a labor guy. I'm somebody who looks to the economy, to jobs, and what kind of jobs you're creating. Not just talking about jobs in this metaphorical sense, but what kind of jobs, what kind of conditions, what wages, what benefits, what kind of a society are we going to have? To me, that's what's important.
Right.
So when I hear Rick Santorum talking about man and dogs and bestiality and all the other insanity that he seems to talk about, I lose interest. He loses me. But then he starts talking about bringing back manufacturing. And I say, yeah, good. Okay. Well, let's talk about that. but he never talks about the details. What kind of manufacturing? Are we gonna bring back the 1950s and have the environmental policies that we had then and the way, you know, are we gonna do that?
I don't know the answer.
I hope not. But you listen to the Republicans. It's all deregulation. So evidently I grew up in Cleveland, the place where the river caught on fire because of the steel mill. Is that what we want to bring back? I hope not. So let's talk about the job numbers. Big numbers, little numbers, your thoughts?
The jobs numbers were actually encouraging today. We created non-farm payrolls, 200,000 jobs in December, which is considered actually a little brightening of the picture. There were actually about 212, maybe a little bit more than that, private employers created, but government jobs, particularly at the local level, were cut, and that brought it back down to 200,000 jobs. So overall job growth for the year was 1.6 million. So it's considered a plus. Now, the other thing that is interesting is, so there actually has been jobs added now for 15 consecutive months since October 2010. The unemployment rate for November was adjusted up to 8.7% from 8.6%. The unemployment rate for December is 8.5%. So it's actually gone down 0.2%.
And just think what would happen to the unemployment rate and to those jobs numbers if we didn't have a gridlocked, obstructionist Republican Party delaying and gridlocking any jobs plan. Because, I go back to November of 2010, and I got the pledge on my desk. I cannot get the pledge out of my mind where the Republicans said, we're going to focus on jobs, 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 with a laser-like focus, and yet all they go after is abortion and voter suppression, gay marriage, and all of the nonsense that I'm just not that into.
Well, you may have an opportunity to ask about that, because I think you'll find that they will say that they have addressed this, that they have introduced bills that deal with getting rid of regulation and addressing taxes and things like this that they believe get in the way of businesses hiring.
All right, let me ask you this, Victoria. We've been talking about deregulation now for more than 30 years. Do we have less regulation today than we had 30 years ago? You know, I look at the trucking industry. We deregulated the trucking industry. There are mountains of pages of regulations. There's no deregulation. It's always re-regulation, always regulating against the little guy in favor of the big multinationals and the big moneyed interests.
I can't speak for the Republicans.
No, no, you can't. I'm just angry today.
I understand.
Angry about a lot of things. So what did our boy Tricky Ricky, Mr. Man on Dog, have to say today?
Well, he had a town hall in Keene, New Hampshire, and there was a mother there whose son survived cancer when he was 5. And so she said, and, you know, he's working now, I think. She said, look, the comments I heard you make in New Hampshire, comments that you support insurance companies' right to refuse to insure people with pre-existing conditions and that you agree with higher premiums for people who are sick. She said, well, my son graduated college and, you know, is it all right for him to possibly be denied health insurance and stuff? So he said the following, and I will just read it verbatim. Insurance works when people who are higher risk end up having to pay more, as they should. In your case, your son obviously did nothing wrong. Obviously, there are a lot of other people that increased their health risk that did do things wrong, and as a result, it resulted in higher health care costs.
Let me ask you this. And I guess this is a philosophical question that I know where Santorum's going to go, because he's free market. It's all about the individual. But isn't insurance like basic? Isn't it the basic pooling to mitigate those kind of high risks, so that when you pool together as a society, you say, you know what, we're going to make sure that if it happens to me and I get cancer, that my rates don't skyrocket, that we're all in this together. I mean,
yeah.
Isn't that the basic premise of insurance?
That's the basic premise. That's my understanding. It's the basic premise. But the other piece of it is, of course, that the people that did do things wrong, what is his definition of this? How is this to be determined? Does it mean that if I wake up feeling blue consistently for 3 months, go and get some antidepressants, then change jobs and try to go to another company, and they won't insure me because I have a pre-existing condition of depression, or they want me to pay high costs. Was that my fault because I didn't have cheerful thoughts?
Well, it's your fault for telling the doctor. And what bothers me about all of this, especially as we're going to it doesn't matter. Anytime you put a third person into this, it bothers me. There are times when I go to my doctor where, you know, I don't tell him everything because he writes it down. And there are things I don't want my insurance company to know. So, I mean,
there's a way around that. You just tell your doctor, don't write it down.
Yeah, that's a good point. But, you know, at the end of the day, you don't know what he wrote back on the chart and how they coded it and all of that stuff.
Right.
But it's, you know, again, I keep hearing the Republicans talking about, well, I don't want anyone between me and my doctor. There is someone between me and my doctor. It's an insurance company.
Indeed.
And I don't like it.
I understand.
Let's talk about
But it's a little disturbing that this idea of punishing those who, quote, did something wrong, you know, that his cancer's fine because he was 5, but maybe a woman of 45 who might have, I don't know, eaten the odd overcooked steak might have brought on her own cancer.
Oh, man, if that's the case, if overcooked steak is going to give you cancer, I'm doomed.
Yeah, it's not very good for you.
Yeah, because I eat everything burnt.
I do, too.
I guess I'm doomed because I can't stand anything red or bleeding or mooing. I can't do it. Not at all, under any circumstance. So I guess I'm doomed. I guess my insurance rate should go up now because, you know, I got one of those little store cards so they know I buy beef. So they should be able to look at what I'm buying and predict into the future that I'm going to be a high risk. So they should be able to charge me now. Well, this is where this is all going, in my opinion, Victoria. But you know, you can call me conspiratorial. So after New Hampshire, I guess South Carolina on the horizon, what's it looking like there?
It's very interesting. There's three polls that have just come out on the 4th and the 5th, and one of them on the 5th, actually Rasmussen on the 5th. And 538, which is Nate Silver, who does all the polling in the New York Times and looks at all the polling, and is really brilliant,
He's good.
Has aggregated them all. But it pays the most attention to Rasmussen because it's the most recent and has the biggest number of people that it looks at. And also Rasmussen's pretty good with Republicans. And he says that Romney has a 59% chance of winning in South Carolina. Santorum has a 25% chance. And that's a big increase from where he was a couple of weeks ago. Gingrich has a 14% chance.
I mean, Santorum took basically Perry's people and Bachman's people, and they're going to Tricky Ricky. I get that.
But you see, if Gingrich dropped out, which he won't, I was listening in on a town hall telecall with him this afternoon, and he's not dropping out. But if he did, he would free up his people for Santorum, with whom he says he's been friends for 20 years, and he would really give Santorum a shot.
Yeah, well, I think at the end of it, it's about Newt. He needs a new book sale. He needs to stay out there, and you know, maybe find another job. Because there are some of them, I think that's why they're in it.
And I think it was true for Herman Cain.
Oh, but I know it was true for Herman Cain. His candidacy looked like a book tour. But he's back on the road again, and I'm hoping he comes to New Hampshire with his solution revolution.
He might. You never know.
I'm hoping. I want nothing more than to be able to get a picture with the man, the legend, Mr. 909, Mr. Cain. I would love that. Since I'm not going to get to meet Michelle Bachman, I am so depressed.
I know, it's a shame because we've got so many male hosts, and they were all hoping that they get to meet Michelle.
Yeah, I'm just so unhappy about that. Who do you think she's going to come out in favor of? You would have to think Santorum, no?
You would think Santorum, really, but maybe she'll be a smart poll and come out in favor of Romney, but he's not her type.
No, not at all. Lastly, the death penalty, again?
Yeah, new Pew Research Center polls just come out. 62% say they favor the death penalty for people convicted of murder. Just 31% are opposed to capital punishment. Numbers are lining up with Pew polling in recent years. And the top two reasons people oppose the death penalty, and they poll at 27%, are because they either believe it's wrong or immoral, or that the justice system is imperfect and could execute an innocent person. And that's gone up in the last 20 years, from 11% to 27%.
That's where I'm at. I've known a lot of policemen over my over my day, and I'm not saying anything bad about cops. A lot of them are good, decent people. But I know there are a handful of them in positions of power that I wouldn't trust with a, well, this is terrestrial. I can't really go into it, but I wouldn't trust. And, you know, I look at O.J. You go back to O.J., I firmly believe Mark Furman tried to plant evidence on a guilty man.
Yeah, no, there are things that happen every day.
Yep, and that's why, that's one of the, again, those are my two reasons. One, I think the system is flawed. And two, you know, that whole religious beating I took as a child, you know, that commandment, thou shalt not kill, I kind of believe in that. But
it'll get through to you.
Yeah, there you go. Well, you know, anytime you get this nasty, evil, sexually repressed nun beating you with a stick, that's where you go. Victoria, always great talking with you. I cannot wait to see you in New Hampshire.
Looking forward to it.
Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Workers in the late 1930s began exerting their recently guaranteed right to organize and join unions. Millions of workers flocked to join the labor organization of their choosing, to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions. Factory, mill, and mine owners, not eager to embrace the changes, fought vehemently to deny workers their rights. As company tactics grew more heavy-handed and brutal, the workers' organizing methods changed. Sit-down strikes became a way for workers to demand their rights and to force management to listen. With a wave of a handkerchief, the tip of a hat, workers would shut down their machines, lay down their hammer, and sit down. Workers at the Hershey Chocolate Factory in Hershey, Pennsylvania, seeking to reduce the 60-hour-long work week, decided to form a union. Initially, an agreement was reached, but as the economy took a downturn, the company willfully violated the agreement by laying off the most senior workers, those who just happened to be the most ardent union supporters. The workers voted to strike the very next day. At 11 a.m. on April 2, 1937, a red handkerchief was waved and the workers began their first sit-down strike in Pennsylvania's history. The company reacted by forming the Loyal Workers Club. These strikebreakers consisted of hired thugs from New York City and local farmers, dairy producers, and shopkeepers who were dependent on the factory. On April 6, Hershey organized a loyalty parade. After hours of rallying speeches, the lathered-up Loyal Workers Club mob found pipes and clubs that had been manufactured at the Hershey planing mill. The angry mob headed to the Hershey factory to throw their strikers out. Songs of solidarity sung by the striking workers could be heard from inside the factory as the angry mob burst into the plant. Blocking the only exit, the Loyal Workers Club, loyal only to management and greed, began pummeling the workers as they tried to escape. The assault left numerous workers bloody and beaten, many unconscious. Within days, Hershey reopened and recognized a renamed version of the Loyal Workers Club. In May of 1938, the National Labor Relations Board ruled Hershey had violated the law and the company union was dissolved. Soon, the workers joined the Bakery and Confectionery Workers Local 464, who have faithfully represented the workers ever since. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments? You can email me, rick at therickSmithShow.com. Don't forget, if you missed any portion of the program, the podcast, there for your entertainment and your enjoyment, there at therickSmithShow.com. Also, if you've got a smartphone, the Stitcher app, you can take the program on the go with you. So, we're going up to New Hampshire. We're going to spend all day Sunday, all day Monday and Tuesday, right up until the big announcement. We'll be back in the studio on Wednesday. Our good friend, Attorney Erwin Aronson, and Dr. Steven Herzenberg from the Keystone Research Center going to be sitting in here Wednesday, as that's our travel day. So that should be a very interesting program. So we hope you'll tune into that. But we're really looking forward to getting up to New Hampshire and seeing the goings-on. We're going into the land, to the world, to the white world. I thought about going in blackface, but that probably wouldn't have been a good idea. Each of the candidates who are left, where do they stand on taxes? Where do they stand on budgets? Where do they stand on job growth? All the things that are important to actual people. The Christian Science Monitor did a very nice little mock-up that I thought, just a little couple of quick talking points to go through. They wrote that the Republican candidates all share the same broad approach. Private sector confidence and job creation through permanent tax cuts, reduced federal deficits, and lighter regulatory business burdens on businesses. In the same vein, the Christian Science Monitor writes, they generally call for efforts to boost trade, encourage domestic oil production and gas production, and limit the power of unions. They hate collective bargaining. But the question is, who has the best economic plan? Who's going to get us out of this mess? I mean, we have doubled down on the idea of tax cuts. We've doubled down on the idea of lightening the regulatory load. We've doubled down on handing money to the very, very wealthy. Are we now going to triple and quadruple down on it? I mean, at what point do you realize what you're advocating is a loser? Well, we've got a bunch of candidates who think quadrupling down, not a bad idea. According to the Christian Science Monitor, Romney, he would extend the Bush tax cuts. He wants to reduce deductions and lower the tax rates over time. So, gonna make sure the wealthy are taken care of. Bush tax rates, fine. Gonna lower deductions, reduce those. You and I gonna probably see some slashes in that, much like the tax reform bill of 86. And gonna lower rates over time so the government doesn't take in as much money. And of course we end up with higher deficits down the road. Also, he wants to change around the tax code to lower the top rate and raise the bottom rates. Very Reagan-esque if you think about it. He wants to exempt capital gains and dividends for households. He also, making over $200,000, they say. He also wants to make sure that they repeal the estate tax and, of course, lower the business tax rate down to 25%. So the idea is more trouble for you and me. He wants to go after China, goes, they're a currency manipulator, but he doesn't say what his plans are. Again, another guy who wants to go after Social Security by hiking the edge. Santorum, he wants a two-tier tax rate, 10% and 28%. So he's going to, again, lower the top rate and then increase the bottom rate. So folks at the very bottom are the ones who get screwed in all of this. And that seems to be the theme across the spectrum. That seems to be their plan. He wants to zero out taxes for manufacturers. He wants to make sure that they repeal the estate tax. They want to cut the corporate tax and rate in half. Capital gains tax, he wants to set at 12%, as well as dividends, which I guess is better than doing away with it entirely. But again, explain to me why it is that someone making their living off of gambling, explain to me why they pay 12%, but why somebody who works for a living has to pay 28%. Does that put any real value in work? Not really. Santorum wants a balanced budget amendment and a line item veto. He also hates unions, so he can be a good Republican. As far as the Social Security and the safety net, well, he's the guy who wants to raise the Social Security age. He championed welfare reform, and he calls the breakdown of the family the key to U.S. poverty. And if you remember what he said the other day, he said that the guaranteed way, is what he said, the guaranteed way to stay out of poverty in this country is to graduate from high school and get married. So you figure that out on your own. Newt Gingrich, he wants to extend the Bush tax cuts, and they all do. He wants to offer a 15% flat tax with $12,000 in reductions and exemptions. Earned income tax credit, he says he's going to keep. Repeal the estate tax, cut business tax down to 12.5%. Yeah, blah, 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 blah. He wants to cut, end Medicare and Medicaid fraud and all the stuff that he claims are going to save him. The reality is he's another cookie cutter. And Huntsman, you know, kind of the same vein. He wants three tax brackets, 8, 14, 23%. Again, raising the bottom. All those poor people at the very bottom, he wants to raise taxes on them. But his is a little different. No deductions or credits whatsoever. He has no tax on capital gains or dividends, no real estate tax, any of that stuff. Going to cut the corporate tax rate to 25%. So, you know, again, right across the board. That's what you end up getting. You get this idea that we're going to slash and burn. And that's the plan. So I'm looking forward to going up and talking to him. This should be exciting and enjoyable. Let's talk to Mike from Iowa. Hi, Mike. How are you doing tonight?
Oh, all right, Rick. I was going to call you about a guy named Bob Vanderplatz from Iowa. Is actually the guy that came in second in the caucuses. Because had he endorsed Barack Obama, Obama would have gotten 20% of the Republican caucuses.
Is he that powerful?
Vanderplatz was the guy that pushed getting rid of three judges that were up for retention in 2010, and all three are no longer on the Iowa Supreme Court. It was over the fact that the Iowa Supreme Court had ruled that gays, like straights, had the right to get married in the state of Iowa.
Now, let me ask you, he gave the endorsement, I guess his group, the Family Leader, right?
His group didn't endorse anyone. They had gone down and they had decided that they would endorse amongst four candidates. And my guess is three of the four were Santorum, Perry, and Bachman. I don't know who the fourth would have been.
So he's not the guy that got himself into trouble for getting paid off, because there was some talk.
No. There wasn't a payoff. What he had done was he had apparently asked that whoever they would endorse as a group would need to get them some money so that they could get out the word of their endorsement.
Well, that's a payoff.
Well, it's not directly a payoff to him, though. What it was a illegal, under federal laws, collusion between the campaigns and an independent group.
Right.
And there's a petition out there asking for the FEC to look into it.
Yeah, I hear the Herman Cain train rolling on behind you.
Oh, yeah, we have Herman Cain, but they're not delivering any pizzas. And, you know, with Herman, it was kind of like whether or not the women he was going out with would have called him out for 30-minute delivery or not.
Oh,
you know, no 60-minute man there.
Ow. So let me ask you this. Are you happy that they're gone? I mean, watching television now has to be somewhat better, right?
Well, now, the thing is, when I actually was involved in local politics, and the last caucus I went to was 2004, I listened to Kucinich, and I was impressed by him, and I decided to rejoin the Democratic Party for at least that election.
Right.
And, I mean, after all, I left the Democratic Party in 1991 taking out the computer files I had been working on as a volunteer for him to the head of the local party, and I said, Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court, I can get this voting Republican. And so I changed my voter registration to Republican.
I don't blame you. There are parts of me that don't blame you, Mike.
Yeah, that was the thing. The thing was, I like I said, if I vote third party, you aren't going to care. But when I vote Republican, you got to make up two votes.
I wish you wouldn't, though.
Yeah, no, that's the thing. I mean, had I gone to the caucuses, I would have probably tried to put in a resolution on the Democratic side to impeach Obama. I mean, I don't like his thing with the National Military Act, where we're now a dictatorship. Americans can be arrested without any cause. I mean, the founders of this country, people that actually knew Benedict Arnold personally, put in the Constitution that the only way you could convict somebody of treason was by having two witnesses to the same overt act, or confession in open court, which meant you couldn't torture the guy and get a confession.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm right there.
But we're no longer that country.
No, we're not. But if I could correct you for a second, Clarence Thomas was nominated by H.W.
Well, no, I know that.
Okay.
But the thing that was, he was put on by a Democratic Senate.
Right. Well, that was a different era back then. They actually talked. Mike, I appreciate the call, though, brother.
Yeah. Take care of them.
Thanks so much. Look
forward.
Look forward to talking to you again. Anyway, have a great weekend. We're going to be up in New Hampshire Monday and Tuesday. We hope you'll tune in. We're looking forward to it. I think it's going to be really exciting. I think it's going to be interesting. I'm excited. But have a great weekend. Also, remember, if you've got any questions, comments, something on your mind, rick@therickssmithshow.com. That's how you can get a hold of me. Or check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. If you've got the Stitcher app, take the podcast with you. We'll see you Monday.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickssmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide and flood beneath the blood of sway. Imperial, mysterious, in amorous array. Democracy is coming. And we